Today's February 10th. This is the Passover Participation Primer at the beginning of Learning Fest 2013. And we're going to take time just to go through the Haggadah. This is probably one of the few classes in my life I've given that I don't have a script exactly what we're going to do. Because we're going to just go through the whole Haggadah, trying to understand what's going on there. I brought Haggadot. I have about 7 or 8 of these, and since we're that number of people, I actually brought that one also.
I
the Maxwell House Haggadah.
Yeah.
But actually, it'll be easier if we all use the same Haggadah.
Yeah, sure.
That'll really be great. Just give these back to me at the end. So there's 2 here, and there's 2 here.
Thank you.
Fantastic. It's not that I'm saying this is a better Haggadah than any others. Good morning, Caroline. It's not that I'm saying this is a better one. It's just one that I have, so we can all stay together. What is good about it is that it doesn't have commentaries. So we just have the text, we can focus on the text, and the printing actually is pretty good, and the translation is also nice. Let's open the Haggadah. Oh, it's so good. I can say what page it is because we all have the same page.
Okay.
This is really fantastic. The Haggadah in this particular edition begins on page 19. That's when we finally have quieter on the table and the leader tells us what we're doing. The way we begin is with the 15-step plan for spiritual Pesach help. Now, let me just tell you, I'm going to throw in a little tips and tricks as we're talking. What I do in my family, I've been doing this probably for 25, even 30 years, goodness gracious, is that each of these steps of the Haggadah, the 15 steps, my kids have colored, have prepared, this is when they were little, on a separate sheet of paper. Now, there's a sheet of paper that says in Hebrew and English, Kaddish. See, that's the first step. And there's a piece of paper that says Or Chatz. That's the second step. All 15 steps. And they're on a piece of paper like this. Then what we did is we strung a thread and let's say the thread is going through the tape. And then across the room, across the living room, we have these 15 pieces of paper hanging, and they're hanging about my head height. That's this first hanging. The second hanging is we have another thread that's strung parallel to this one, and this thread is a little bit higher than the one with the 15 piece of paper, and hanging from that thread is an arrow, a cardboard arrow, and it's hanging so it could be moved on the thread, on the string, and the arrow is pointing down. Again, the arrow is hanging a little bit higher than this piece of paper. You have these pieces of paper hanging 15. And then we move the arrow as we go from step to step. Was that clear what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And either one of the kids is appointed to move the arrow at the proper place. And very often we try not to tell him or her when, but they have to be aware what's going on and move the arrow when they think it's the right time. Then, of course, if they move it at the wrong time, someone says, no, you have to get up and move the arrow. That's pretty nice. We've done that really for a long time. And like I said, the 15 piece of paper, they were colored by my kids in second grade or third grade, I don't remember. But the truth is, if you have a painter or a good artist in the house, you can really have it done very nicely. And it doesn't just have to be small pieces of paper like these. It could actually be big, so you can cover the whole room with this timeline of the Seder. So anyway, and of course, feel free.
Use the word, I mean, like sanctify or...
You know what you could do? You could do it like we did it in Hebrew, Hebrew letters, and in transliteration, and then in English. One says sanctify or make kiddush. Let's just go through them. The first says make kiddush, sanctify, right? The next one is wash. The next one is eat vegetable, or just vegetable. The next one is break. This is a very good Haggadah because it has in bold face one word that really explains what's going on. Narrate, or I call that the story of the Exodus. Wash again. You can see I don't have to go through them enough to bore you.
Okay.
Everyone has a Haggadah at home, and you have this at the beginning of the Haggadah. So anyway, everyone sits down, and you can tell them about this chain that is hanging from the room and what we're going to do with it, and then you appoint a kid or a grandchild, or not an adult, to be in charge of the arrow. At our stage, and I think this is pretty common, pretty traditional, we sing the table of contents. These 15 stages, there are different songs, and you can probably listen on the internet, on YouTube or something, to different tunes. I'm really not going to teach you the tune because you won't know it if I teach it.
Oh, do you sing as well as I do?
Better.
Oh, better?
But I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know. That's what my kids say.
So we,
Mom, yeah. Please don't sing.
Okay, you convinced me to sing. Okay, so after we sing, and we sing three or four times, and some families we sing in different tunes. First this tune, then the second tune, then the third tune, the table of contents of the Seder. And then we turn the page, and we get to the first stage. And of course, as soon as we turn the page, you're expecting that person who's been appointed to move the arrow to move the arrow to Kadesh. Kadesh means make Kiddush. It's very similar to the Kiddush on Shabbat. There's no reason for us to go through it. You have it in your Haggadot, and that's fine. By the way, you might want to remember that there's a custom of leaning during the Seder. Is that familiar to anyone? Haseva. And the drinking of the four cups is one of the times when we lean. So the Kiddush is the first of the four cups. And the custom is to lean to the left-hand side. You could do it comically. Lean all over each other and make a mess of the wine. There are pillows around, so you can lean comfortably. It doesn't really matter. After Kiddush, why do we lean?
No, why do we lean? I know. Why to the left?
Oh, the Talmud says that if you lean to the right, it's dangerous. Now, is that anatomically true? I don't think it is. But the Talmud says if you lean to the right, the food will go down the wrong pipe. The food? Yeah, the food will go down the wrong pipe.
Well, we always say start with your right foot, is everything the right?
But here
right
we lean.
Thing.
But here I we do Hashevat Smol. Hashevat Smol, leaning to the left. Okay, so after we have drained the cup of wine, leaning to the left, we get to the next stage. When the leader says we're going to the next stage, of course that's the sign for the person to get up and move the arrow. Orchatz. Orchatz is on page 22 on this sheet. And perhaps just to remind you, we wash our hands at this stage without a blessing. Without a blessing. We do wash our hands ritually, which means a cup, right, twice on the right hand and twice on the left hand. What is pretty common is...
Fine. We try.
What is pretty common is that we don't get up from the table to a sink, but rather someone brings around a bowl and a cup of water, and then that person either washes the hands of those around the table, or the person himself washes his own hands, but the point is you don't get up, but someone else brings the water and brings the towel. Again, that's without any blessing.
This is like symbolic, it's not actually real.
It's a complicated halachic development, why we do it, but without a blessing. So I'm not going to bore you with all the details, so I'm going to keep this practical. Practical. So we do orchatz, which means and wash. Already we got here to the second stage of the Seder. And then we get to the karpas. If you want, we can hold our fingers now to the bottom of page 22 and 23, where it says karpas. And we can just go back to the table of contents on page 19 and to notice that we've now reached the third stage. Right? We went through kadesh, orchatz, karpas, to sanctify the wash. We get to the vegetable. That's pretty straightforward.
What is the shurish chatz mean?
In orchatz,
right.
Resh chet sadi, it means indeed to wash. Resh chet sadi, right? R-C-H-T-Z means wash. That's pretty straightforward. What might you know it or have heard of it? You might have heard of it in one of the five forbidden acts on Yom Kippur. One of them is rechitza. You can't wash your body.
Bathe.
Perhaps sometimes it's translated as bathe, but really Yom Kippur, it means you can't get your hands or your face or your feet, you can't wash them. Yom Kippur, and of course also Tisha B'Av. There we have Richitza, washing. Yeah. Now in Karpas, you might see in your Haggadah, you might not, a little notation, I don't mean in this Haggadah, but when you have it at home, you might see that it says, eat less than a kazayit, eat less than an olive size. That's actually a halachic disagreement, how much you're supposed to eat. Some authorities say you have to eat less than an olive size, some say you have to eat more than an olive size. And at this point, I usually make the point in the Seder that it's a good idea to eat a lot of vegetables to keep stomachs from rumbling. Because as we know, that if people are hungry, they're not going to listen, they're not going to have a good time. So I know one very prominent teacher of mine, whenever he would have guests over for the Seder, and he always had 20, 30 guests over a year, he'd tell them, you have to come a half hour before the services in the synagogue, and he'd serve them a bowl of potato soup to make sure that 2 hours later, they're not going to be hungry. Because again, if your students, if your family, if your grandchildren are hungry, it's not going to work. So in addition to having a bowl of potato soup before the Seder begins, before synagogue, we have the karpas, which we could use as another way to keep people satisfied. And there's no reason it has to be. It doesn't have to be just one stick of celery. Karpas could be a whole bowl of salad on the table. That's really fine. In addition to the salad, I remember that when I was growing up in Sinai Reform Temple in Bayshore, Long Island, going back lots and lots of years ago, the rabbi had a family custom of having a hard-boiled egg for the karpas. Don't ask me why, but ask him. And we asked him why. He said it symbolizes Paro's hard head. So really, this is a time for appetizers. If you do the traditional karpas of vegetables, then we say a blessing over it. The blessing here is on the Haggadah, in the Haggadah, at the bottom of page 22 and 23. It's a blessing over fruit of the ground. Right? Baruch Ata Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, Borei Pri Ha'adama. If it's going to be a hard-boiled egg, then there's a different blessing, the blessing over things that are not the fruit of the ground. Okay. These are all preliminary things until we get to the real stuff, of course, in the Haggadah. This point is going very quickly. And your Seder should go pretty quickly until we get to here. And then we turn the page to Yachatz. Of course, the minute you turn the page to Yachatz, your person in charge of the arrow gets up and puts the arrow one step forward. Yachatz comes from the root in Hebrew that means to break. And this is when we break the middle matzah. Okay? We break the middle matzah, and of course, one half we put aside for everyone together. The Afikoman, right? So everyone knows that. I will point out one of the major reasons that we break the middle matzah is to turn the matzah into the bread of affliction. If you might remember that we call matzah lechem oni, which means bread of affliction. Perhaps I'll write that in Hebrew and English on the board. The Torah calls matzah lechem oni. Lechem oni, which is lechem, of course, is bread. Lechem oni, the bread of affliction. And the Talmud says that afflicted people, poor people, people who suffer, don't have a lot, they tend to eat their bread in crumbs. They just gather up whatever crumbs are available. And therefore, to emphasize that the matzah is indeed the bread of affliction, we make sure that at least one of the matzot is not full, is not whole, but is the type of thing that you'd eat if you didn't have a lot of money. You gather whatever you can eat. So we do the yachatz. There's no really big deal about it there. You can see in the... Should I see this now? Yeah, I'll say this. No, say the next step. Say the next step. So we break the middle matzah. And then we get next stage, Magid. Now Magid is the telling of the story. The telling of the story is the major part of the Haggadah. Like this one stage is going to have everything inside of it. So now things start getting interesting. The way Magid begins, as you can see, is by saying this little paragraph of this is the bread of affliction. Ha lachma anya, that's in Aramaic. Lachma anya, can you see it there in the Hebrew? On the right hand side of the page, right under Magid, it says ha lachma anya. And the words lachma is the Aramaic for lechem, for bread, and anya is the Aramaic for oni, which means affliction. Ha is this. This is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. So now, in our family, what we do is we take the broken matzah, and it doesn't matter if you use the one that's going to be the afikomen or the other half, we take it and we wrap it in a napkin and we pass it around the room, and each person who gets it puts it on his shoulder and says, this is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Whoever is hungry, etc., etc., let him come and eat. Whoever is needy, let him come and celebrate Passover. Now we are here, next year may we be in the land of Israel. Now we are slaves, next year we'll be free. You don't have to have people saying the whole paragraph. They can just say, this is the bread of affliction, and pass it on. But the idea, of course, is participation. That everyone gets to hold the matzah on his shoulder and to say, this is the bread of affliction. Now, there is a custom, I think it's a Sephardi custom, in which they do what I just said, put the matzah on their shoulder, pass it around, and say something, but they don't say the words written here in the Haggadah, this is the bread of affliction, they say something else. And you can actually see in the small print here that this particular Haggadah gave us, let's look at the small print. It says there in about the third line of the small print, some briefly place the afikomen portion on their shoulders. In accordance with the biblical verse, recounting that Israel left Egypt carrying their matzah on their shoulders, and say, Bivhilu yatsanu mimitzrayim. Bivhilu, that means with haste, we left Egypt. So some people say those three words, passing the matzah around. Some people say the words that are written in the Haggadah, that's the bread of affliction. In any case, it's a way of making it real, helping people to participate, keep attention. But now I want to stop for a second and summarize an hour-long presentation that Carol Ann once heard from me in 5 minutes. Notice the contradiction between these two different customs of what you say when you put the matzah on your shoulder. What the Haggadah says, and this is what I said we do in our family, we say, this is the bread of affliction. Whereas the other custom is, we say, in haste we went out of Egypt. Right? Got that? So look at the difference here.
It's like behalah.
Yeah, right,
so
which means quickly.
It's quickly, but it's also like with like fright.
Right, because remember what the story says, that Paro had his firstborn in the middle of the night killed, and he gets up and says, you Israelites, get out of here quickly. It's bivahilu, it's
with
haste and
with fear.
With fear, with absolutely, fear. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. So now, I'm pointing out there's a contradiction here. This matzah that we are holding at the beginning of the Seder, what does it symbolize? What is it about? So one version says, this is the bread of affliction. The other version says, in haste we went out of Egypt. As you can see in the small print there, it's recounting the fact that Israel left carrying their matzah on their shoulders. Remember that the Torah says that they carried their dough that they were going to make into bread on their shoulders, but it didn't have time to rise because they had to leave the middle of the night. So they took it as dough, and then they made matzah. They couldn't make bread because they didn't have time for the bread to rise. So if we think deeply, we have two different understandings of what matzah is here.
You get more people coming.
Okay, so we'll stop and let them come in. Good morning.
Hello, hello.
Dan Selassie, hey, nice to meet you again. Good morning. What is your name?
Where do you want us to...
Wherever you want. If it's good for you,
can I sit here?
That's fine. Yeah.
I promise I don't bite. I've had all my shots.
So what is your name?
Bud Silverberg.
Bud, I'm...
You may know my wife, Rina.
The truth is I'm very good at forgetting people.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if I know her.
Okay, that's all right.
So, Bud...
A couple of years ago, she was in the class at
Melton. Okay. So we have Bud, and we have Linda, and we have Nahama, and we have Carol Ann.
Oh, I know Carol Ann.
Okay, so you feel at home. And we have Dan.
I know Dan.
Dan and Bruce and Karen.
What's your last name?
Bud Silverberg.
So I'll give you a Haggadah, and I'll give Dan a Haggadah.
We're gonna,
okay. I have enough. I have enough. We're on page 24. We're on page 24. So the matter is like this. The Haggadah says, this is the bread of affliction. Now, and the other statement we said is that this is the matzah that they carried out with them when they were on their way to freedom. And I'm pointing out that we have here two different understandings, I would even say contradictory understandings of the matzah. Because let's think, if this matzah we're putting on our shoulder, if it symbolizes their flight to freedom, when they just had that dough, that everything is going so quickly, they can't let it rise, they have to make matzah of it, well then that matzah that we're talking about, that they left with, symbolizes the flight to freedom. It's something good, it's something positive. It's the whole center of our celebration, freedom. But if it's the bread of freedom, we would not call it the bread of affliction. Do you get that?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you call it the bread of affliction?
Because you were slaves.
Because we were slaves. So then exactly, we come to the following conclusion. Listen to this. If you remember in the Torah, it's in chapter 12 of Exodus, but there's no need to look. We are told by God, through Moses, that on the last night of slavery, when you're still in Egypt, everyone should take a Paschal lamb, remember that? And they should eat it with matzah and bitter herbs, and they're going to eat it that last night of slavery, and at the end of the meal, Paro's going to find that his firstborn are killed, take the firstborn, and he's going to run into your house and say, get out of the country. Which means that the Israelites were commanded to eat matzah before they left Egypt. Do you have that? If anyone has a question, just stop me. So how could or why would they be commanded to eat matzah before they left Egypt? Why, if only when they leave, will matzah become a significant symbol? Because when they leave, right, the bread went on time to rise. So it turns out, that matzah symbolizes the flight, the hasty flight to freedom. Now, matzah is a symbol of Passover because they didn't have time for the bread to rise and became a symbol of freedom. Then why in the Seder, the last meal in Egypt, were they commanded to eat matzah, but matzah wasn't significant yet? The event didn't happen yet that turned it into the bread of freedom. If anyone's not following, please stop me. Dan, got it? Karen, got it? Right?
Yes. But also here in Halachmania.
Yes, yes. So
it
that's. Great! That's exactly the Hama. That point was so good that my chair fell down. Because that's exactly the point.
What'd she say?
She'll say it again, the chair will fall. Just watch this.
It says here, Halachmania, this is the bread of poverty or affliction, the achalu that they ate, av hatana, our fathers ate it, be'arad mitzrayim, in the land of Egypt.
Of Egypt, right.
They ate it before they left.
Exactly.
Because all during the slavery, this was the bread that they ate.
Exactly. You heard this class from me? Or from someone else?
But I have a question.
It says it right there?
In the Hebrew,
But I have a question.
Okay.
If they ate it in Egypt before they were let go, then it had time to rise.
No.
Didn't the bread have time to rise? Because they hadn't been let go yet.
Good. I'll explain.
Eric, let me give us a try here.
Okay.
If Hashem told the Israelites within an hour's notice that they had to leave and to make the Korban Pesach, to make the sacrifice of the lamb, then there was not time, I would think. And matzah only takes 18 minutes to bake. whereas bread needs to rise first and then bake. So, you know, I think that's part of it.
Well, the truth is they knew that they were leaving that day.
Yeah. Well, they did
but
know.
They thought it would be in the morning,
yeah,
and it ended up being midnight.
Yeah.
Let me give the whole back. We only gave a hint yet of where this is going. So here we have the following. We've come face to face with a contradiction within the Torah, and I'm going to put on the table the contradiction as we've heard the pieces of it. Point number one. It says in the Torah that you're supposed to eat matzah in the final meal of slavery. Okay? Right? With the sacrificial lamb and the bitter herbs. Point number two, on the same side of the scale, the Torah calls matzah the bread of affliction. Those 2 points are on one side of the table, on one side of the scale. On the other side of the scale is the fact that the Torah says that they ate matzah as they were going out to freedom. It didn't have time to rise. And matzah is the bread of freedom. So here's our contradiction. On the one hand, the Torah says matzah is the bread of affliction, and that they ate it before they went out to freedom, at the last meal, the Last Supper. By the way, the Last Supper really was a Seder. On the other hand, the Torah says that matzah is what they ate when they're leaving for freedom. With haste they left with the dough on their shoulders. They had to bake it as matzah. There wasn't time to let it rise. And it's the bread of freedom. So now that's the question. What is matzah? Is it the bread of slavery? Is it the bread of freedom?
Can it be both?
And that's the answer. Look at that. Chair, fall down. But let me just give more background.
Okay. Yes.
So the commentators say the following. Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra was a Spanish commentator on the Haggadah and on the Bible in the 11th century, going into the 12th century in Spain. And he was a world traveler. And in his commentary, he says that when I was traveling in India, I was jailed. And in jail, they only gave me matzah and water to eat and drink. I don't know if it's 3 months, whatever it was, only matzah. And why did they do that? Because it's cheap. It's easy. It's a very basic food. There's no great expense in preparing it. There's no sweetness. There's no taste. It's just matzah. And the slaves or the prisoners get by with it. They don't really need to eat too much. They get constipated, and that's all they eat. Another commentator points out that it's not only that matzah is a cheap and simple food, it also takes very little time to prepare.
Right.
And if you're a slave and your time is not your own, you might be forced, when you're a slave, to eat matzah because you don't have the luxury of waiting for the bread to rise. Okay, so now, what that brings us to is the following. The supposition, this is not written any place in the Torah, but this is a supposition of commentators, that during all the years of Egyptian slavery, or during most of the years of Egyptian slavery, the Israelite slaves ate primarily matzah. For all the years of slavery. Why primarily matzah? Either because the Egyptians fed it to them, and the Egyptians wanted to save money, save time, right? And didn't want to give the slaves something that was tasty or something that was expensive. They just gave them matzah. Or perhaps it's not the Egyptians gave the Israelite slaves matzah to eat, but rather the slaves themselves had to prepare their own food, but they had no time. So they just put the greens together, put it in the oven, took it out, ate it, and went back to work. Matzah. Whether you look at it from the point of view of the Israelites preparing their own food, or from the point of view of the taskmasters giving the Israelite slaves their food, you can understand from both points of view that it could be they ate matzah. Hear that? That would explain why the Torah calls matzah the bread of affliction. The matzah reminds us of how bad it was to be slaves. Because the matzah reminds us of the fact that you don't have time, your time is not your own, or reminds us that your life is worth very little, that things aren't tasty, that they just give you the cheapest thing, whatever it is from the point of view of the taste or from the point of view of the time, we can understand the idea that matzah is the bread of affliction. It's the bread that we ate in slavery. And therefore, we can understand that in the last meal, the Last Supper, which was the first Seder, as they're about to go from slavery to freedom, that God commanded them to eat the sacrificial lamb, we'll explain later why, commanded them to eat the moror, the bitter herbs, because that reminds them of the bitterness of slavery, and the matzah also is a reminder of the bitterness of slavery. Okay, that's why it's the bread of affliction, and that's why it says, this is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt, as Nechama said, in the land of Egypt. In Egypt, all those years, we ate matzah.
Wait one more second.
Okay. But, so just think of this. Let's say that the supposition we're presenting is true, that you, as a slave, have been eating matzah for your whole life. And let's just say that it's also true that your father and mother ate matzah for their whole life. And let's just say it's true that your grandparents ate matzah for their whole lives, because we've been slaves for all these generations. And now God tells us that tonight is your last night in slavery. You're going out to freedom tomorrow morning. And I want you to sit down in Egypt to have this meal of the sacrificial lamb and the matzah and the maror. And when you're eating this meal, in imbibing the maror, the bitter herbs, and the matzah, you're reminding yourself, you're symbolizing, you're concretizing that this is the way it's been for all these years and it's about to change. So the meal symbolizes the slavery and its upcoming end, okay? As you're eating that matzah at the Seder in Egypt, and you know that tomorrow will be going to come free men and women, what are you thinking about? What are you dreaming?
Freedom.
And
no more matzah.
So what food you're dreaming of? Eating bread. Just imagine at the Seder, it's 11 o'clock at night, you're crunching on that disgusting matzah, thinking of the constipation that you've had for 210 years, and you're eating the maror that really tastes so bitter, and you know you've gone through this for your whole life, and your parents have gone through it, and your grandparents have gone through it, and God said, we're going to freedom tomorrow. Well, freedom is the bakery. Freedom is challah. Wow. Right? Freedom is cookies, and freedom is all of that stuff.
Donuts,
okay. Freedom is all those things that rise, that have a good taste to them, that they're fluffy and they're soft, it's easy to chew them and digest them. You are thinking of having bread tomorrow. And in anticipation of that, you put all your dough in the knitting trough, and you're not immediately making matzah of it, because you know that we're going to now have time. We don't have to be slaves anymore. Tomorrow we're going to be free men, and the bread is going to rise all night. The dough is going to rise all night. And tomorrow, Parah is not going to tell us to run to work. Tomorrow we're going to have time to let it rise even more and to put it in the oven to make beautiful bread. So you were dreaming of challah tomorrow. And then, middle of the night, plague of the firstborn. All the Egyptian firstborn are killed. Paro knocks on the door. Get out of here right now. What do you say to yourself? You say, but I want time for my bread to rise. I don't want to leave Egypt right now. But Paro forces all the Israelites out. And then what happens? They're forced to eat as their first meal. It's free men and women. They're forced to eat again. Matzah! They wanted to eat bread. Now they're eating matzah, the same matzah they ate for 210 years in slavery, they're now eating for their same meal as free men and women. But now the matzah has a completely different meaning. Because now the matzah will remind them not of the slavery, it'll remind them of the fact that they had to leave before they anticipated, how to leave quickly, how to leave in the middle of the night with behilu, right? With haste and with
trepidation.
With trepidation. So what I just said in the past 10 minutes is a condensed version of a larger story in which you see that the way the wheels of history turned took the bread of affliction and turned it into the bread of freedom. Was that clear?
Yeah.
Right? So it turns out that at our Seder, the matzah is really a dual symbol. It's both the bread of affliction that we ate for 210 years, but it's also the bread of a freedom at one and the same time. And that ties us back into what I said 10 minutes ago, we break the matzah. Since the matzah has both symbolisms in it, how do we, at the beginning of this Seder, emphasize the symbolism of slavery by breaking it and making it poor man's bread? It's not just matzah, it's not just tasteless, and it's not just constipation creating, and it's not just lacking sugar and spice and anything nice. It's also broken in pieces. That
so you're talking about the apokomet when you break it.
Right, I think you missed that a minute before we you walked in. Like we break it, and part of it becomes the apokomet. So that emphasizes the fact that it is the bread of slavery, the bread of affliction. As it says, this is the bread of affliction. Yeah, oh, actually, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, the half, and then, the half that you put in the
napkin?
In the cover and hide, is that part the affliction or the freedom part?
We don't really make that distinction. We don't make that distinction.
Doesn't make any difference. Right. All right, the second question is, if the Israelites were eating matzah while they were slaves, did they ever have any bread at all, or was just bread not existent?
Who knows? Right, the truth is, the Torah doesn't say, the truth is, I made up this story. I'm saying this tongue-in-cheek, I made it up.
It's a good story.
As a answer to a question. Why does the Torah command to eat matzah before they left for freedom? Why does it call their bread of affliction? So the commentators, and I'm bringing you what they said, create this historical idea that they ate all those years matzah to explain the facts, to explain the data. Now, we of course know that later on in the Torah, when they're in the desert, and they complain, they say, we remember the meat and the fish and the vegetables we had in Egypt. We want to go back to Egypt. It's in the desert, all we have is this manna. Because how can I say that they ate only matzah in Egypt when they say later, oh, we remember all the great stuff. We sat by the flesh pots of Egypt and we enjoyed ourselves. Well, obviously they are
dreaming,
right? They didn't sit by the flesh pots. They built the pyramids.
Delusional.
Delusional. But Bruce wanted to say something, and then Nahama.
He asked both my two questions.
Oh, okay.
Well, and also too, I mean, I'm not even a cook, okay? But when you make bread, bread has other things in it. It has salt in it. It has yeast in it. It takes time. It takes time to rise. It takes time to bake. It takes, like you said, it takes lots of time. But it has... and it's work, but it has ingredients in it that if I were the slave owner, I would want that in my food, but not your food.
Right, right.
You know, why would I give you valuable
Absolutely.
Ingredients?
Right.
Salt was incredibly valuable.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that's all true. And actually, that's why for the matzah of the Seder, there's forbidden to be in it anything tasty.
You're not supposed to have egg matzah.
Right, egg matzah you can have other times, but for the Seder,
right.
not egg matzah, not even
you can't
sugar.
Have matzah for the Seder.
Seder itself, no. And not even matzah baked with sugar or spice. No, it has to be.
Chocolate.
It has to be cardboard. It has to be bad tasting. That's the essence of lechem oni, the bread of affliction.
I see it like, you know, all the Magid is for me, it says here, it's an invitation to everybody to come to our Seder mm-hmm. and to experience with us the affliction and the slavery that the Jewish people had. And actually, every Jew also needs to go through it again, because slavery is not just gone and we have the freedom. We fall back to the slavery. We are enslaved to our anger. We are enslaved to so many things during our life that we actually, yes, we want to be free and we taste the freedom, but we forget it. So we need like reminders constantly.
It's true.
So
it's true.
This is why it is, yes, it is this. Matzah is the symbol of slavery and freedom at the same time, because we fall in all of this. We experience it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
We are struggling.
We are struggling, yes. Bruce.
In this past week's Parsha, Mishpatim, mm-hmm. it talks about indentured servants, slash slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were there any similarities in the way slaves in Egypt were treated versus indentured slaves of Hebrew citizens?
All I know is what the Torah says. So let's think of what the Torah says. The Torah says that at the outset, the slaves were given kash, straw, to build, to make bricks. And later, it says that there was denied them the straw. They had to go throughout Egypt to get to find the straw and then to make the bricks. So it looks like they weren't kept in chains, right? They can go throughout Egypt and find the materials, but they had a quota. And the Torah actually has five different words for quota. They had a quota of bricks to make every day. That's one piece of information. Another piece of information is, remember what happened when Moses went out of the palace, and what did he see? He saw a taskmaster beating a Hebrew. So apparently there were whips, and there was really torture. But beyond those two incidents, I don't know if we have a real picture of what it was like. Of course, we do have from periods in history that are near the period that the Israelites were in Egypt, we have paintings or carvings of slaves in Egypt building the pyramids, right? We've all seen that in museums, right?
Yeah,
and it doesn't look so
much fun. But the repercussions were given a lot more, were taken care of a lot better than the Jews when they weren't. Isn't that true? I mean, a lot of rules about how you had to treat a slave.
Right, like if but you put
how do
like
we treat our slaves?
That's
right.
What I said. Yeah. That's yeah.
If you put out an eye, that you have to let him go.
Yeah. So there's no reason to think that that's the way it was for the Hebrew slaves, the Israelite slaves in Egypt.
Right. Right. So, I mean, we could call them indentured servants or slaves, and I think it's not really correct to call the people beholden to Hebrew citizens as slaves, because it's not the same thing.
Okay, but that's a different can of kosher worms, right?
Right.
Okay.
This was yesterday's.
Makes you feel better to call them indentured.
Indentured servants. Yeah. I mean, they weren't whipped, and, you know, I mean.
They were treated better.
So, at this point, I want to finish up with the point we've been making by doing the following. While we're all on page 24, where we've been, I also want you to turn for a moment to page 44.
44?
44. And I want to read from a different part of the Haggadah. The top of page 44 and 45, about five or four lines from the top, it says, Matzah, why do we eat this unleavened bread? Everyone see that?
Mm-hmm.
I'll read it in English. Matzah, why do we eat this unleavened bread? Because the dough of our fathers did not have time to become leavened before the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He, revealed Himself to them and redeemed them. As is written, they baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into unleavened bread, for it had not been fermented, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for the way. So that part of the Haggadah, on page 45, presents matzah as the bread of
freedom.
Of freedom. Whereas on page 24, matzah is the bread of
affliction.
So I just want everyone to see the Haggadah clearly contradicts itself. And it contradicts itself on purpose. Because, as I forgot your name,
Bud
said, both. They're both true. They're both true. And when we sit down to our Seder, we're eating double matzah. Matzah that has this meaning and matzah that has that meaning. Both at the same time. Good. Okay. Back to page 24. So we did the matzah on the shoulder, passed it around the room, we said what we said, and then what happens at this point in the Seder is something that 95% of Jews don't know about. It's in tiny print in some Haggadot. In other Haggadot, it's completely left out. In this Haggadah, they have it. Look what it says. In small print, the Seder plate is removed. Does everyone see that?
I didn't know that. Oh, there's lots of things I don't know.
So I'm going to tell you briefly what's going on. What's going on is the following. You might know that one of the reasons we do things that we do this evening is so that the children ask. we do strange things to arouse their participation and their curiosity. In ancient times, I'm going back to the time of the Talmud and in the Middle Ages, what they would do at this point is they would, I have to explain, that the tables were tripods with a plata on it. Did I say that in English? Platter? A platter on it? Mm-hmm. Right? And you could just lift up the platter and take it to the kitchen or dump it out into the garbage. What they would do at this point is akirat hashulchan, removing the table, which means removing the platter. Why did they do that? Because in ancient times, again, at the end of a meal, after you ate, you wouldn't take the dishes to the kitchen, you take the table to the kitchen and just dump it out. They didn't eat on plates. They ate on the table, on the platter.
Oh, so the table was the platter.
The table is the platter, right? The platter is the... How do I say this in English?
Tabletop.
The tabletop, right? That's on the tripod. So in ancient times, in the meal, they would just take the tabletop and dump it. At this point in the Haggadah, before we eat, the ancient sources say we should remove the tabletop as if we finished the meal, but we really didn't start it. Why do we do this crazy thing?
Because the kids get all excited. Where's my dinner?
Exactly. Exactly. Right? To get the kids involved.
Attention. Yes.
Get their attention.
Okay.
When I was a young man and my kids were 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 6-year-old, we would do akirat the shulchan at this point, remove the table. Of course, we didn't have a tabletop we can remove. We take all the dishes, stack them up, take all the silverware, take all the nice things on the table, and the kids are watching.
They think it's over.
What's
it's
going on?
They think it's over.
How about we don't do it now?
There are people that do it symbolically by pushing the Seder plate aside. But people don't understand really why they're doing it.
They bring it back?
Right. But what you're really supposed to do at this point, and if you have some audacity, then you can try this at home, is at this point, just start telling everyone, okay, let's bring everything into the kitchen, let's stack up the plates, the dishes.
It's over.
But there's no historical significance here. It's just psychological significance.
The truth is, there is a larger story behind it. I'm not going to tell you the whole story because we want to talk about practical things here. But what I do want to show you... Oh, I didn't bring it, actually. I didn't bring that source for you. Okay. I didn't bring that source for you. But the Gemara does say that they did akirat shulchan. They took away the table top, and the kids said, "What's going on here?" And the rabbi said, "I'm glad you asked that question. Now we can bring everything back."
It just so happens.
So,
which means if somebody doesn't ask, you're in a home.
That's right, you're in trouble.
Watch out.
Linda. Question.
Because you just said exactly what I was about to say.
I didn't hear what you said.
What did you say?
What happens if nobody asks?
Oh.
And do you know what the answer to that question is? What happens if no one asks?
It means they are asleep or they do other things.
Okay, but practically speaking, what happens in the Seder if no one asks?
No one answers.
No, we're going to ask.
No participation.
What did you say?
We're going to ask them what?
We're going to train them to ask. And now I'm going to throw a bombshell out.
Uh-oh.
Everyone knows the four questions,
mm-hmm.
right? According to the real authentic Seder, there's not supposed to be four questions. Rather, the children are supposed to spontaneously say, "Why are you taking away the table?" And if they say that, "Why are you taking away the table?" then we skip the four questions.
Oh.
The four questions are a replacement for authentic curiosity. If they didn't ask on their own, then we do a kind of rote and we train them to ask. But that is only a second best solution. What's really supposed to be is no scripted four questions. Rather, it's all your kids getting up and crying, "Where's the table? What are you doing to me? I thought we're having a Seder tonight. I'm hungry." And just to show you that I'm not making this up, we're going to go back to the sources from 2,000 years ago and read this.
Do you have more of those?
Yes, I do. one, and Dan doesn't have, and Carol Ann. Okay. So, this source is from the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Psachim, page 116a. And it says, they filled a second cup for him. This is in the Seder. At this stage, the son questions his father. If the son is not perceptive enough to ask, his father instructs him. Why is this night different from all other nights? For on all other nights we eat unleavened bread and unleavened bread, whereas on this night we eat only leavened bread. Second question, on all other nights, b'chol halelot, we eat all kinds of herbs. On this night, bitter herbs. Third question, on all other nights we eat meat roast, stewed or boiled. On this night, roast only. Fourth question, on all other nights we dip once, but on this night we dip twice. Notice what just happened. It said that we instruct the child to ask these questions if he wasn't perceptive enough to ask. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this is a second best scenario. But the first best scenario is that you've done things strange enough so that the kids ask spontaneously. And then there's no need for the four questions. And the Talmud, as it thinks about this Mishnah and discusses it, tells a story. And the story is the following. Rav Nachman asked his slave, Daru. And I guess Bruce would say Daru wasn't a slave, he was an indentured servant. But that's a whole different story, right? When a master liberates his slave and gives him gold and silver, what should he say to him? He should thank and praise him, replied he. You have exempted us from saying, Ma nishtana, observed he. Thereupon he commenced by reciting, Avadim Hainu, the rest of the Haggadah. In other words, in this particular case, Rabbi Nachman was leading a table of family, and his indentured servant was sitting around the table. And Rabbi Nachman said, if I were to liberate you and give you gold and silver, what would happen? And the slave said, well, I would thank and praise you. And Rabbi Nachman said, okay, we don't need the four questions. We just had enough of a dialogue. We can begin the story. And that actually is the basic idea, that the four questions are unnecessary. Now, I'll tell you the truth. I once learned that there is a difference between theory and practice in the following fashion. So my kids were young kids, and 3-year-old, 6-year-old, 8-year-old. We did Akirat Shulchan. We removed the table. The youngest started crying and saying, what's happening? Where's the Seder? We prepared for this night for so long. We said, good, you asked. We'll bring everything back. We'll start. And we skipped the four questions. And she said, no, I want the four questions. My kindergarten teacher's been working this for a month.
Let me ask you a question. What is the answer to the question, why are you taking the tabletop away?
So that you'd ask.
So that you ask.
Yeah.
And then you start the story.
Yeah. In other words, it really is just a method of arousing interest.
Absolutely.
There are other things we do that have a more essential meaning, like why are we having bitter herbs, right? Why are we having matzah? Those have a real answer, not just I did it so you can ask.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, this night we want to do all types of things. Some of them have essential meaning, some of them have no meaning, just in order to arouse a sense of curiosity.
Okay, so if the kid asks, or if the kid doesn't ask, which kid is he, the four sons? The Chacham?
Anyone asks, they're all good.
With the adult kids, you can only do that the first year after that.
Well, the first, the second, the third, but you're right. You have to always
alternate
and improvise.
By the time I've taken all my dishes and all that stuff out and set the table, I'm not
here. I'm with you on that.
Particularly if there's 30 people.
That's right.
Although you could have a system in which you have a tabletop that's on a tripod and just get two strong men to carry the whole thing into the kitchen.
Yeah, cardboard.
Okay, so let's go back to the Haggadah. So at this point, we have the four questions. I'm not going to say anything deep about those four questions. Again, you don't have to use the four questions. And the best scenario is not to use the four questions. Of course, when we start the four questions, we move the arrow again to Magid. Right? Or when you say Halach Ma'anya, the spread of affliction, the kid who's in charge of the arrow has to remember to move the arrow from stage one to stage two.
They were
two
not here with the arrow business.
Okay, but I'm not going to say it again. You had to miss something. You came late, so it's like you missed something. But thank you, Bruce, for being so considerate. I'm not so considerate. Okay, so you have the four questions. And then you can see, after the four questions, I'm on page 26 and 27. It says the Seder plate is returned. Right? That's when we return everything. The kids were aroused. And now we can begin.
It's returned after protests of everybody, or just returned?
When people speak up and say, what are you doing? Then we bring it back.
Okay.
Of course, if no one spoke up, then they say the four questions, and then we bring it back. We pour the second glass of wine, by the way, and when we now begin answering the questions, the Haggadah says in small print, the matzah are uncovered. That's true. We have a custom that when we speak during this night, we want the matzah to be witnessed, as it were. So the matzah are uncovered. Okay. So now, in the midst of Magid, of the telling of the story, the main commandment of the night, the children asked, we're answering. But strange as it is, the answer doesn't begin immediately. Or I can say it differently, the answer begins but stops. And it's going to begin again and going to stop. What happens is that at this page of the Haggadah, page 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, there are all different type of introductions that are preliminary to the actual answering of the questions. Why are we here tonight? What are you trying to teach us? What's this story of the Exodus from Egypt? We don't immediately begin telling the story, but there's some preliminaries here. And why do I emphasize that? I emphasize that because if you are in a situation in which the kids are very small or the adults are very fidgety, are not interested, I want you to know where the real telling the story begins so you can skip to there. So just let me just say this. We're now on page 26. Mm-hmm. Hold your finger there and go through 27, 28, 29, 30. On page 30, if you want to make a little... Okay, the Haggadot are not yours, you can't make a mark, but if you're taking notes, you can note to yourself that in about the 10th line of page 31, it says, originally, our ancestors were idol worshippers. In Hebrew, Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu. That's the beginning of the answers to the questions. But until we get there, it's preliminaries that if you have to skip, you can skip. Okay? And Bruce, you wanted to say something?
You opened a can of worms in my head.
Kosher worms, I hope.
Kosher worms.
You have kosher worms in your head.
No. Yeah. You talk about kids not protesting. Are kids protesting or not protesting? Does a slave protest or not protest? So I'm thinking there is some relationship to protesting in a slave. If
slaves usually don't protest.
Don't protest.
Slaves have been broken.
Right.
That's a very good point. That's a fantastic point.
Yes.
That all the agitation and all the question and answer and the give and take of the Seder is just the opposite of a slave mentality.
Correct.
Jews are always free. Jews are always asking and protesting. Relating to what I talked about on Friday night.
That's right.
Yeah. So let's look at the Haggadah. Back at the Haggadah, page 26 and 27. And it says right in the middle of the page there, Avadim Hayinu, I'll read in English, we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, but Hashem, our God, took us out from there with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm. That's one line, right? Now that could be an answer to the question, what are we doing tonight? And the answer is, we're commemorating, we were slaves, and God took us out. And indeed, the Talmud suggests that as the beginning of an answer to the question. But lo and behold, we're now going to see that after the Haggadah gives that one-line answer, it leaves it aside and goes into preliminaries. Instead of directly dealing with the question, what are we doing tonight? What's the story? What's going on? What do you want to remember? After that one line, we leave aside the story and we go into introductions and preliminaries, which I said that if you have to, you can skip. So let's look at the preliminaries. Here we go. Had not the Holy One, blessed be He, taken our fathers out from Egypt, then we, our children and our children's children, would have remained enslaved to Pharaoh in Egypt. Even if we were all men of wisdom, understanding, experience, and knowledge of Torah, it would still be an obligation upon us to tell about the Exodus from Egypt. The more one tells about the Exodus, the more he is praiseworthy. So let me just make... yes, Dan.
Yeah, I have a question here. I was thinking the Israeli was slave for Egyptians, but over here I see only...
Uh-huh. No, Pharaoh is a symbol of Egypt. Paro is the man, right? It's like we talk about Obama as the government, right? He is the symbol. He is the head of the government. But it doesn't mean that Paro was directly there in the fields with the whip.
No, he's not in the field, but they are slave for him. So only his officials have power over there, not citizens.
Uh-huh. I guess that's true. I guess. So, in the words that we just read here, we are being given instructions of how to tell the story, but it's not the story itself. You understand what I'm saying? In a certain sense, you should have read this to yourself the day before to remind yourself, if God hadn't taken the Israelites out of slavery, well, we'd all be slaves right now, to this day. That means that it's a experience of my family, of me. It's real for me. It's meaningful. It's direct. And therefore, if I already know the story, I still have to tell it. And the more I tell it, the more praiseworthy. And I want to explain what this instruction is trying to tell you. So here we are. Moving away from the Seder completely, and the family has gotten together for Thanksgiving or for the Super Bowl, and you take out the albums from your grandmother's wedding, and you start showing it to the kids. The kids have seen it 5 times already, last year and the year before and the year before and the year before, but everyone still wants to see it again. Because you're looking at the album, not in order to learn things you didn't know, but in order to re-experience your own history, your own sense of family, your own sense of who you are. Every time I tell my kids the story about how I was 5 years old and this, that, and the other thing happened to me, they've heard it already. But they want to hear it again because it's who they are. And not only is it who they are, but I am molding who they are by telling them the story again and again and again. But the story is not for information. It's for experience. And why is experience so important? Because we're all one family. And what happened to my ancestors happened to me in a certain sense. We're all together. That's what this is saying. Even if we're men of wisdom, you have to tell the story again. The more you tell it, even if you know it already, it's important because it's not about knowledge, it's about experience. Okay? Next paragraph. It happened that Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon were reclining at the Seder in Bnei Brak. They discussed the Exodus all that night until their students came and said to them, "Our teachers, it is daybreak, time for the reading of the morning Shema." Why is that paragraph here?
I have no idea.
Can anyone figure out why it's here?
And I always hated that because I could never say the words right. You know, if I was asked to read, I'd say, "Please don't give me that paragraph."
So really, it's not connected. It's not telling the story of the Exodus. It's rather telling a story of how others told the story,
exactly.
Right?
It says here that to show that also great sages
who know this story.
Yes, mm-hmm. Also we come
right.
Story.
That's it. That's the answer. It's a pedagogical reminder of what we just read at the end of the previous paragraph. Even if you're smart, even if you know, even if you're well-informed, even if you're a great rabbi, we still tell the story again and again and again, because we're telling it not in order to learn what happened, we're telling it in order to create shared experiences. We're showing family movies, and we want the kids to know this is your family. If you've seen it once, we're going to see it again. In the end, after we've seen it 20 times, we want to see it again and again and again, because it's us. It's me. Okay? So this paragraph is not a fulfillment of the mitzvah of telling the story. It's rather a pedagogical reminder to you, the leader, how you should be telling the story again and again and again, even with people and to people who know the story. So it's very important, but it's not the purpose of what we're doing tonight. It's just an instruction to you, and therefore, if you have to leave it out, be my guest. But certainly you should have absorbed its message. The next paragraph is the same thing. It's a reminder to the teacher, to the leader, of the importance of what's going on. Let's read it. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, I am like a 70-year-old man, but I could not succeed in... I'm changing the English translation there. I could not succeed in proving that the Exodus from Egypt be mentioned every night until Ben Zoma expounded it. In order that you may remember the day you left Egypt all the days of your life. That's a verse from Deuteronomy. The phrase, the days of your life, end quote, would have indicated only the days. The addition of the word all includes the nights as well. But the sages declared that the days of your life would mean only the present world. The addition of all includes the era of the Messiah. So what's going on here? It's very simple. There are two different commandments connected to telling the story of Egyptian slavery. One of them is every day of your life, and that's the mitzvah to remember. Mm-hmm. And the other mitzvah to tell, and that's only at the Seder night. Two different mitzvot. The paragraph we're reading is not even about the mitzvah of the Seder night. It's not about the telling. It's about the mitzvah of remembering, which is every single day.
Zachor.
Every single day.
Zachor
v'shamor. No, that's Shabbat, right?
Yes,
Zachor v'shamor. And the verse says that you should remember all the days of your life. And here the rabbis are debating, what does all come to include? If I just said the days of your life, so, fine, the days of your life. What does it mean all days of your life? One opinion says all means every part of the day. Not just the day, but also the night. Another opinion says all comes to include not even the days of your natural life, even the days of your supernatural life, and the days of the Messiah.
Oh, wow.
All. What does all come to include? The nighttime, or does it come to include the future time? But according to both opinions, what we learn from this is that it's really important to remember the Exodus. This paragraph is only here to remind you of the importance of it. Again, it's not answering the question the kids asked. It's not why we're here tonight. It's an instruction to the leader how to relate to what's going on tonight, that it's really important. But that's all. So we really haven't gotten to the meat of the Seder yet. We're still in preliminaries. And it's so unfortunate that in America, as in many other places, people's time is short and people are fidgety. By the time we finish the preliminaries, people are so... how would I say? People are so distracted or so tired, we get to the real stuff, it's too late to command their attention. So you have to know who your audience is, and if you have to skip, this is the stuff to skip. Okay? We're still here?
Yeah.
Still here.
So you don't have to skip anymore.
Okay. Blessed is the omnipresent, blessed is he. Blessed is the one who has given the Torah to his people Israel. Blessed is he. Concerning four sons does the Torah speak, a wise one, a wicked one, a simple one, and the one who is unable to speak. And then it says, the wise one, what does he ask? What do we tell him? Then the wicked son, what does he ask? What do we tell him? The simple son and the son who is unable to ask. Okay. Why is this here? It's not a telling of the Passover story. But again, it's a pedagogical instruction. And it's telling you that there are all different types of children, all different types of Jews sitting on your table, you have to know how to gauge and calibrate your words so that everyone has something they can latch onto. That's why we have this section in the Haggadah. But again, I'm going to bore you now. It's not the essence. We haven't yet got to the telling of the story. We're just telling you how to tell the story. How to tell the story? With language that could be understood on different levels. Or vary. Sometimes talk to this child, sometimes talk to that child. But it's all about pedagogical instruction. It's not yet the essence. Okay? Okay?
This is really interesting.
I hope it's making sense.
I never connected that.
Okay, so look, so you're making me feel good. At least someone's getting something out of it.
That's really
you're getting your money's worth.
Okay, so we're not going to spend our time in this room on this midrash of the four sons. It's really not of the essence. I'm just going to say a few words about one of the sons because it has something directly related to what we're talking about here, and that's the wicked son. Let's look at the wicked son. And it says there, the wicked son, the Rasha. What does he say? Quote, of what purpose is this work to you? The word work is not a good translation. The word in Hebrew is avodah, which means service. And he's saying, this Passover Seder that you brought the whole family here and you're boring me to death, what's the meaning of it all? What's the purpose? And he says to you, so then the Haggadah says, he says to you, thereby excluding himself. He used the Hebrew word, you, he didn't say us. By excluding himself from the community of believers, he denies the basic principle of Judaism. I'm going to stop there. This is really fascinating. The first thing I'm going to point out is that the Art Scroll translation got it very wrong, and it got it wrong on purpose, because they have an agenda. And some of you who know me know that I constantly rail against Art Scroll. This is a perfect example of something they've done that, in my personal opinion, is terrible. I'm going to read again the end of the third line and the fourth line. By excluding himself from the community of believers, the word of believers is not there in the Hebrew. The Hebrew just says, by excluding himself from the community. So now, let's think. The Haggadah is telling us that anyone who says, you guys, y'all, and he doesn't include himself, he's excluding himself from the community, and he's called the Rasha. He's called the wicked son. That is so, so important. Because who is the wicked son? It's not the son that eats and drives on Yom Kippur. And it's not the son that breaks Shabbat. It's not the son that doesn't eat kosher. It's not the son that goes to, I don't know, to a Buddhist temple. It's the son who says, I'm not part of this. In other words, here is one of the basic elements of Jewish theology, that the first and most important principle is not what you believe, and not even what you do, it's rather who you think you are. Mm-hmm. That what we first and foremost want is identification as a Jew, that you're part of the family, that this story is your story, and indeed the whole purpose of this night is to help people feel that that story is my story, is our story. But if there's someone there who doesn't want to be part of the story, then it doesn't matter what Jewish practices he does and what Jewish beliefs he believes. If he doesn't see himself as part of the family, then really we have a big problem. That's what the Haggadah is saying. And it's really so important to this whole evening, because the whole evening is about developing a sense that this is my family, this is my story, this is my history. I'm part of it. It's what I always like to call an sense of expanded identity. I am not merely Hanan Schlesinger. I am Jew. And my parents and my grandparents, and going back to King David and back to Moses and back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's part of who I am. And I'm supposed to understand that I'm not just here today and gone tomorrow. I wasn't just born in 1957. I'm not just going to die tomorrow another 30 years. I have been born 3,000 years ago. And I am eternally alive as part of the Jewish people. And one of the purposes of the Seder is indeed to inculcate within me and to strengthen within me that sense that I am part of a larger family that defines who I am.
Would you say a Jew has become a Christian, or an Epicurus is included in, as a Rasha?
Right, so the question is, who is a member of the community? all I can say is the first thing is self-definition. If the person defines himself as part of the community and sees himself as part of the family, that's a good beginning. Then there are all type of hard questions, I understand. What the boundaries are.
If someone was born Jewish and still identifies as Jewish but doesn't go, is not observant or doesn't go to shul.
So at least they say they're part of the family. That's a good beginning.
Family, yeah.
And now I'm going to grind my axe for just 1 minute. Why did Art Scroll put those words of believers into the text that aren't there? Because they want to define who the community is.
Mm-hmm. They want to find what?
They want to define who the community is. But it doesn't say that in Hebrew. They're telling you who's in, who's out. The believers are in. Everyone else is out. But that's not what the text says. And that's certainly not what traditional Jewish thought says. It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of self-identification. Now, I'm not saying that belief is not a good thing. Belief is a very good thing. It's good to believe in God. Fine. It's important. It's essential. And it's good to do the mitzvot. Of course it is. It's very important. But the text doesn't say that. The text just says that as long as you define yourself as in, then you're in. That's what the text says. Okay. I'm getting off my soapbox now and I'm going to stop grinding my axe.
No, but I think that's really important because I probably am the least educated here. I don't speak Hebrew. I don't read Hebrew. Okay. But if somebody says, who are you? Or what do you believe? I say, I am a Jew. I belong to Temple Emmanuel. I do this, I do that, whatever. Okay. But if you start excluding people, well, you can't be a Jew because you don't read Hebrew. Or you can't. If you start putting conditions on it, then we have further, I think, diminished our community. And we don't want to diminish. We want to grow. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily to proselytize to others, but to not exclude our own.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. That's my soapbox. I'm done.
there's another in this Haggadah, the contrary child, I think, is in this one.
Really? As opposed to the
Yeah. What is the meaning of this ceremony to you, saying to you, he excluded himself from this group and thus denies a basic principle of our faith? That's how they
Yeah. Again, the Hebrew just says a basic principle. They say of our faith. Yeah. They mean of our people.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Okay. So now, at the top of page 30 and 31, there's a paragraph that is a continuation of that child that doesn't know how to ask. I am going to... should I say something about that? I'm going to skip that. And we are going to now go to the paragraph of originally our ancestors. And this is where, finally, we almost begin to tell the story. Okay? So let's read. Originally, our ancestors were idol worshippers, but now the omnipresent has brought us near to his service. As is written, and it brings a verse from the book of Joshua. Okay. What I want to do now is hold the finger here and go back to page 26 and 27 and compare. Okay? So we're comparing page 27 to page 31. On page 27, right in the middle of the page, it had said, we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, but Hashem our God took us out from there with a mighty hand and outstretched arm. Okay? And I said that was a one-line answer to the question, what are we doing tonight? What's the story? What's the whole importance of this? But then we didn't continue. We went into pedagogical advice. Now we get to page 31, and we again begin or try to begin telling the story, but we begin differently. We say, I'm reading again on page 31, originally our ancestors were idol worshippers, but now the omnipresent has brought us near to his service. Okay? And I want to compare that statement on 31 to the statement on 27. You hear what I'm doing? The Talmud asks the question, what story are we telling tonight? And it gives two alternative answers, and we just read the two alternative answers, the one on 27 and the one on 31. And they're both included in our Haggadah. I want to point out the difference between these two alternative answers. The first answer was slavery to freedom, mm-hmm. right? The second answer is idolatry to monotheism. Okay?
It's another way of slavery. It's also...
Very good. Very good. Okay, that's really nice what Nechama said. You could look at idolatry as a type of slavery and monotheism as a type of freedom.
Sure.
I'm going to say it a little bit differently, but I like that answer also. I'm going to talk about the big picture and the little picture. In other words, there's a big picture of Jewish history, which is from idolatry to monotheism, and the move from slavery to freedom is part of that. It's like two concentric circles, or even we can say it like this. It's like a timeline. Right? We have, in Jewish history, we have slavery to Paro, to freedom. We certainly do. But that's embedded in a larger story, which is the story of idolatry to monotheism. Within our journey from idolatry to monotheism, there is a sub-story of slavery to freedom. Slavery to freedom in the physical sense. And the question is, when we're here at our Seder tonight, are we here only to tell the sub-story of slavery to freedom? Or are we here to tell the bigger story, that this is a story within a story, the bigger story of idolatry to monotheism?
Don't they both fit in together?
And of course they fit in together.
Sure.
But the question is, can we and should we isolate the smaller story and just tell that tonight? I'm assuming tonight is your say tonight, for you. Or to make sense of it, do we have to tell the larger story?
Well, but in going through all the plagues that God performed, you're really showing that he is one person, that he is one God.
That's true also. But it means in a historical sense. So I want to talk about the fact that our forefathers were idolaters in Mesopotamia. Abraham's ancestors.
No, I follow you. Yeah. I understand.
So what's going on here in the Haggadah is at the very beginning we said slavery to freedom, but we didn't keep talking about that. We then gave pedagogical advice on how to do the Seder. Now we finished the pedagogical advice. We're beginning to tell the story, and we're opening up the canvas to the larger tapestry, I would say.
The major thesis of the Haggadah and Pesach has always been freedom. And a sub-story may have been monotheism, but we don't think of it as a major story.
Okay.
At Pesach.
At Pesach.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So perhaps I could say the following. That slavery to freedom, in other words, we were literally slaves to Paro and we left and now we're free, that story really has minor significance unless you see it as part of a larger move of idolatry to monotheism. To put that in different terms, freedom, so what? Physically free, so what? Okay, I understand there's a big advancement there, but still, that freedom is fully consummated only when seen as a move towards understanding your place in the universe. So we're embedding the slavery to freedom in a larger saga, a larger narrative that's really about finding our place in the universe as members of a people chosen by God with a certain mission to bring ethics and justice and monotheism to the world. Without that larger story, freedom is important but not as important. To put it differently, we're free to do something. We're free for a purpose. We're free in order to bring a larger vision of meaning to the world. And without that larger picture, freedom is important, but not that important.
What you're saying is that we've been underemphasizing the major theme of Pesach all these years.
That's what the Haggadah is saying. You don't need me. It says it right here. Okay? So originally, our ancestors were idol worshippers. But now the Omnipresent has brought us near to his service, as is written in the book of Joshua. Joshua said to all the people, so says Hashem. It's a quote from the book of Joshua, right? The sixth book of the Bible. So says Hashem, God of Israel, your fathers always lived beyond the Euphrates River in Baghdad. Terach, the father of Abraham and Nahor, and they served other gods. Notice, please, that it's they served other gods. It's not him, it's they. In other words, it's not just Terach, it's Abraham and his brother. In other words, our father Abraham, our great monotheist, he began his life as a idol worshippers. Mm-hmm. So there's a journey here. It's not just where Abraham was always a monotheist. He discovered it. It's about a spiritual journey. Then I took, this would be God speaking, then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river, from beyond the Euphrates, and led him through all the land of Canaan, the land of Israel. I multiplied his offspring and gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau I gave Mount Seir to inherit. But Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. There's something really deep here that to me is essential to catch. Jacob went down to Egypt, but Esau was given by God Mount Seir. What we're really seeing here is that there are people who get what they need and they're finished. The Jewish people, the children of Jacob, while Esau got Mount Seir, we got a journey. Look at that there.
Mm-hmm. Right? To go to Egypt, to go to slavery.
In other words, and this is a major theme in the Torah, that for the Jewish people are on a journey. We don't just get what we want, we just don't get what God wants us to have, and we're finished. We are moving. And it is sometimes, I would even say often, it's discouraging and frustrating. Jews never get what they want immediately. We're on a journey. It's a process. It's not about stability. It's not about being there. It's about being on the way. And that's so powerful in these verses from the book of Joshua. And that's why the Haggadah brings it, because tonight we're not telling about a certain place. We're not telling about stability. We're not telling about being there. We're talking about a process. A process. And it's not just the process of slavery to freedom, it's the larger process of idolatry to monotheism, and within that process is exile to redemption. So look what I'm going to do now. I have another color here. We have the slavery to freedom, that's the story inside. And then we have the larger envelope, the story of idolatry to monotheism. But now we see that there's actually another level within the larger story, which is exile to, how should I call it? To the land. Let's say to our land. And I'm going to put that right here. Right here I'm going to put exile, and I'm going to put land. So there's a story within a story within a story. The biggest story is idolatry to monotheism. The tiny story within that is slavery to freedom. But there's also the story of exile to the land. It's idolatry, exile, slavery, freedom, land, monotheism. There are three levels of the story here. And again, I'm going to sound like a broken record. The idea is process. The idea is long term.
Look. There's a fourth level.
Okay.
And it's a level you mentioned the other night.
Okay. You're arousing my curiosity?
Yes. It's a level of, you called it a process. right? And what kind of process is it? Why we use the word derech? What's inherent in the word derech? Growth, maturation.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Right, right. Very good, very good. This is the story of the Jewish people growing up.
Right.
And reaching slowly, I shouldn't say reaching, but slowly moving towards our goal. Right?
It means that the person, when a person is born, is not free. It's not that you inherit freedom. You are not born free. You need to go through it, like you say, process, stumbling, a affliction to understand what is freedom.
Yeah. I agree with Nechama. That's a good comment. Mm-hmm. But I do want to say something that's a little bit in tension with what you said is. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're emphasizing the process of the individual.
Yeah.
Whereas I just want to point out that almost everything I'm saying here this morning is really about the process of the collective and not about the process of the individual. Mm. Right?
However,
one is contingent upon the other.
Of course. But this big picture is not merely the big picture of my life. It's the big picture of our life together as Jews.
But implying personal life.
Say again?
It implies personal life.
Yes, of course. You're right. It's made up of individuals and it can apply to our lives absolutely. But as modern people, we have a tendency to reduce everything to the individual.
To us,
right? Yeah. And I know I'm old-fashioned, but I'm emphasizing the whole meaning of this Haggadah is just the opposite. It's us getting out of our shell as individuals and understanding ourselves as part of a collective.
Yeah, but look, I see myself on that process, as the same thing like you put it.
Yeah.
So as an individual.
Yes.
I'm not against that. You can do that. And that's what the Hasidim do. Nechama hinted earlier, without even saying it directly, that the Hasidim translate all this into personal processes. They talk about every person leaving their own Egypt, their own straits. Right? Now, that's nice, and it's meaningful, but it's not the original meaning of this. This is not about the individual. This is about the collective.
Without the growth and maturation of the collective or the individual, there's no such thing as going from idolatry to monotheism, and there's no such thing as understanding psychologically from slavery to freedom. So there has to be a process of maturation and growth in order to understand and experience and believe in the rest of it.
Okay, I'm good.
Uh-huh. I mean, you better understand if you take it personally, this process.
Okay, look, I'm not going to argue with you. Individuals are also important, of course.
I think that in order to belong, I need to work on my individuality first. How can I belong if I'm not working on myself?
Okay.
Because to belong, I think it's a bigger concept.
And I think what you're seeing here is that we're realizing that with this growth pertains to continuing the story. And otherwise, you have incidents where you experience the rasha that can't relate because they don't internalize the story.
Right.
And that's the biggest threat to Judaism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The growth of the collective comes through the growth of the individual. Is that correct?
He's not disagreeing. He's just saying that's not the point of this.
But there's something bigger. Like, take for example, you have, I think, thousands upon thousands of Jews, not so much in the 21st century, but the end of the 20th century, that found personal fulfillment in Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Right? Buddha Jews. And they really were searching to grow as human beings, and that's beautiful. And that's powerful. And they probably didn't find that within Judaism because they intuitively realized Judaism emphasizes the collective and less the individual. But they were looking for individual spirituality, for individual growth, and their consciousness didn't allow themselves to see themselves as part of a larger family that goes back to Abraham and is stretching towards the future.
Yeah, I have a neighbor who's a Buddhist.
And that's not a criticism. It's just a fact that our 20th century culture didn't give us the raw materials to think about ourselves as part of a larger collective. And that's really the purpose of the Seders, to bring us back to that consciousness of being part of a collective. That's beyond ourselves. It's more meaningful than ourselves. And I personally think that that is a source of great, great meaning. If you're able to see yourself as part of a family, part of a chain of tradition that goes back thousands of years and has a glorious future in front of us, that could be a source of great meaning for, in life.
Yes, but if you look, for example, Abraham, how did he get to be the father of such a big nation? He started himself. He grew up, and then he got to be. The same thing with Sarah, everybody. It means that to be part of, you need to grow to be ready to be to belong or to.
You're right. You're right. But on the other hand, you are right. But on the other hand,
yes.
Let me just give you one example before we go on. God promised Abraham, "I will make your seed as many as the stars in heaven, as many as the grains of sand on the seashore." When Abraham died, he didn't have too many children. But he didn't die in frustration, because he knew that that promise is for the long run. So it's true that he did individual work on himself, but he also saw himself as part of a larger picture. And I'm sure that much of what he did was in that context. It's not just for me right now. It's for the future. Okay. So now the Haggadah says as follows. Blessed is he who keeps his pledge to Israel. Blessed is he. For the Holy One, blessed be he, calculated the end. The words "of the bondage" are not really there in the Hebrew. It just says "end." So I'm going to leave them out. The Holy One, blessed be, calculated the end in order to do as he said to our father Abraham at the covenant between the parts, as stated in Genesis 15. He said to Abraham, "Know with certainty that your offspring will be aliens in a land not their own. They will serve them and they will oppress them 400 years. But also upon the nation which they shall serve will I execute judgment, and afterwards they shall leave with great possessions." So here is Abraham, a long time before his great-grandchildren go down to Egypt. And he's being given a prophecy by God that says, "You know what, Abraham? I have great news for you. Your sons are going to be slaves." That's the great news. That's the promise God makes to Abraham. You are going to be, your sons are going to be exiles in a foreign land. They're going to be oppressed there. Right, say it again. For a long time. And in the end, I'm going to punish those people that enslaved you, and you leave that land with great possession. Great possessions, wait, we're going to leave with television and computers. It's really going to be great. But think about the significance of God making a wonderful promise to Abraham, your grandchildren are going to be slaves. Wow, that's just so exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
But what is it about? It's about process. God is telling Abraham, "Yes, I made these great promises. Yes, you're going to get this land, but it's going to be a long haul. And there's going to be ups and downs in that long haul. You first have to go down to Egypt in order to leave there and to enter the land of Israel." Again, in other words, this slavery to freedom is only part of a larger story. Right? The slavery to freedom is embedded in God's promise to Abraham that I'm going to give you the land. But in order to get the land, in order to go from Mesopotamia to the land of Israel, you have to go through slavery to freedom. And that's part of a larger picture of idolatry to monotheism. To get from idolatry to monotheism, you have to go from exile to the land. You have to go from slavery to freedom. In other words, there's process within process within process. There's layer upon layer upon layer. There are little pieces of the picture, but they all have to be understood in the context of a larger tapestry that goes on for hundreds of years. And now I want to show you, to me, one of the most deepest and meaningful parts of the Seder. We're going to read on. Look at this. It is this that has stood by our fathers and us. V'hi sha'amda la'avotenu v'lanu. For not only one has risen against us to annihilate us, but in every generation they rise against us to annihilate us. But the Holy One, blessed be He, rescues us from their hand. It looks like this paragraph of four lines is not part of the story we've been telling. We were telling a story of idolatry and exile and then slavery to freedom, to the land, to monotheism. And suddenly, we talk about in future generations, the Goyim, the Gentiles, always trying to kill us, but God saves us. What's the connection?
Being a Jew is not hard. Is hard.
Yes.
And it takes that perseverance.
Yes. Let's go back and see how that fits into the words. I'm going to read again. It is this that has stood by our fathers and us. Do you see those words?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask a really easy and a really hard question at the same time. It is this. What is the this?
Slavery?
No.
The promise.
The promise. The this is the promise. And by the way, it's in Hebrew in the feminine. It is this he, feminine, going back to the haftacha, the promise, which is feminine. Okay, so now, listen closely. God made a promise. It said in the previous paragraph, blessed are you who keeps his pledge to Israel, his pledge, his promise. And now, it is this promise that stood by our fathers and us. For in every generation, they tried to annihilate us, but God saved us. What's the promise? Exactly, what's the content of the promise?
That God will always protect us.
Okay.
Or save us.
Okay.
I would say save, not protect.
Say protect. What is implicit in what Linda just said?
God is with us.
Okay. Something deeper.
You're going to have to go through the process.
Yes, so that's why I'm going to say the words. That the downs are as much part of the promise as the ups. In other words, this is really powerful. God keeps his promise to Israel. What is his promise? His promise is we'll always be suffering slavery upon slavery upon slavery and exile upon exile upon exile. In other words, what we're saying is that this process on the board was not a one-time thing. But in every generation, the process is still going on. Every generation, what does it say? Behold, door of a door, in every generation, they rise against us to annihilate us. And God saves us. The promise is not that God will save us. The promise is that they'll come to annihilate us and God will save us. In other words, the downs, the suffering, the exile, the slavery is part of the promise. And why does it say it here in the Haggadah? Because it's not that we have this thing in the past, which is idolatry, exile, slavery, freedom, land, monotheism. No. In every generation, we're still in the process. In every generation, they come to annihilate us and God saves us. What it's trying to say is, this is still going on the board. It's not over. It's not over.
And it won't be over, apparently.
And it perhaps will never be over. That to be a Jew is to be involved in a process, and God promises you it's not going to be easy. I mean, on the one hand, this is very, very hard to hear. I've sometimes taught this, and people really... Wait a second, if that's the promise, then I'm walking out the room. No, but...
Then I'm done.
Yes, but it is also a lot of hope, because we are constantly, you know, we fail, we stumble, we are in big trouble, but we know that there will be a redemption.
Well,
so this is something that we will work for, because we know that there will be the light at the end.
But we also probably say to ourselves... Remember Fiddler on the Roof?
Why do you pick on someone else?
No, but let's say it for real.
Why do you pick on us? Yeah, why?
How do you say it? God, couldn't you choose someone else?
Yeah,
but this is part of life. We know from what happened in Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, that life is not perfect. We're flawed. And it's not just us. It's everybody. But if we lead a life of Hashem, that it's a light that guides us through these difficult times. And throughout the centuries, though great civilizations have come and gone, we have persisted and
persevered.
And I mean, we look at the Americas. I mean, our whole Judaic, our whole criminal justice system is based on Mosaic law. So there's something that to be gleaned from the centuries, including mercenary and other things. And so, yes.
You know, Rabbi, it seems to me that the process is designed to make us stronger.
Right.
And that may be the reason that we've survived, whereas the Babylonians and all the others have just disappeared.
Right, that's what I was saying, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about...
But it's not easy.
How about when the Mashiach comes, quote unquote, will there be the same problem?
Oh, that's a good question, and in different forms I've been asked that many times. So I'll just give an answer, a short answer, which is this is probably one of the reasons why the Rambam emphasizes that the Messianic times are not the end of process. Because the end of process is really the end of the meaning of life.
End of days.
That the Messianic time is not a time when everything is perfect. It's a time when things are closer to perfect. And it's a little bit easier to go through the processes, but the processes don't end. Because when processes end, the meaning of life ends. At least, that's as Jews, how we understand it. Right, okay. So... we are pushing forward. We're still in Magid. We're not moving our arrow because we're still in this telling of the story.
Where it's almost 11 o'clock. Let me just
tell you. I realize. So that's 3 hours. It's not enough. It's just scratching the surface.
I thought 3 hours was too much, but I'm feeling it's not enough. This is
really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anyone else want to get up for a minute and stretch our bones?
Let's go to the restroom.
Yeah, okay. So we'll wait 2 minutes.
Restroom around the corner?
It's further down the end of the hall, going to the right.
Yeah, are you related to Cal?
Well, it's very good. So we are now, we finished page 30 and 31 with that song we sing, It Is This That Stood By Our Fathers and Us. And we get to the top of page 32 and 33. Go and learn. And I would put a semicolon after go and learn. Say ulamat. What Lavan, the Aramean, attempted to do to our father Jacob. For Paro decreed only against the males, Lavan attempted to uproot everything, as it is said, and Aramean attempted to destroy my father. Stop. I know that's not the way it's punctuated, but I'm stopping there. So what I just read, I just read, go and learn. And what I think that means is the following. We just said on the previous page that in every generation they rise against us. Now go and learn means go and learn. I'm going to show you an incident in which that happened, in which they tried to get us. And what incident is that? That's Lavan the Aramean who tried to destroy Jacob our father. Now there was Paro later that tried to destroy all the males, or the Jewish people. But look how the paradigm of persecution and salvation actually began even before the Egyptian exile and before the salvation from that exile. It actually began with the third of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob went through the same thing as an individual that later the Jewish people went through as a collective. That's what's going on here. And how do we know that Jacob went through that? Because there's the verse that says, an Aramean attempted to destroy my father. And we understand that my father refers to Jacob. An Aramean is Lavan, his father-in-law. Mm-hmm. And this verse is found, as you can see, in Deuteronomy 26:5. Okay, so we just explained why the story of Lavan and Jacob is here. Again, it's a paradigm or a pre-paradigm of what happened later in Egypt and what happens throughout Jewish history, that we're always in danger and we are saved. This, the exile and redemption, or the slavery and the freedom, or the persecution and redemption, it happens again and again and again.
I don't know how did Laban destroy
doing his part.
Oh, thank you very much, Carol Ann. Very good. The problem is, that Carol Ann is pointing out, that the verse doesn't really say what the Haggadah says it says. Let's open up to the verse. So we'll open up to the Torah, and we're looking at Deuteronomy 26:5. Everyone should have on the table. Then that's good, but here, the blue one has is the same translation here. Okay, so we're opening up to Deuteronomy 26:5, and the page 314. Page 314. At 26:5. And it says, in the middle of verse 5, my father was a fugitive Aramean. You see those words? My father's a, those are the same words that are translated in the Haggadah as an Aramean attempted to destroy my father.
That's not the thing.
Right, so in Hebrew, it's three words, and they are ambiguous. Three ambiguous Hebrew words. I'll write them on the board. The words are Arami Oved Avi. Aramean, my father. So that's clear. There's an Aramean in the verse. There's only three words in Hebrew. Aramean, father, and the word Oved. What does it mean? It could mean destroy, it could mean wander. The verse might mean an Aramean wandering or wanderer was my father. An Aramean wanderer was my father, or it could mean an Aramean destroyed my father. We don't know what it means. We don't know what it means. The Haggadah interprets it to mean that an Aramean destroyed my father, and understands that it refers to Laban, Jacob's father-in-law, who, if you remember, swindled him.
Right.
Again and again and again, and made life very difficult for him. In a certain sense, it's so difficult that he gave him the wrong wife. Remember, he had to spend another 7 years working there, 7 years, 14 years. In other words, an Aramean put my father into exile for lots of years. The Haggadah understands the verse like that in order to show us that this pattern in Jewish history of suffering and exile began even before the slavery in Egypt. Okay? So now, at this point in the Haggadah, we talked about two different... don't close it. You closed it already. We're going back to that. So we've talked about lots of different introductions to the story. We talked about pedagogical tricks and advice. We talked about two different paradigms. One is slavery to freedom. The other is the larger story of idolatry to monotheism. And we gave some introductions to the story. At this point, now I promise I'm not going to put you off any longer. At this point, the story really, really, really begins right now. Right now. I said it began kind of at the top of page 30 and 31. Originally, our ancestors were idol worshippers. And that was the beginning of the story. But now we're really getting down to brass tacks exactly what happened in Egypt, and that's happening at the top of page 32 and 33. And now we're going to explain what's going on. We've now gotten to the centerpiece of the Haggadah. This is it. If you have to skip other things, you skip everything else, but this is now it, as far as the words we say. Okay, so here we are. We're sitting at the Seder, and it's come time to really tell ourselves and our spouses and our relatives and our children, our guests, to tell the story of our exodus from Egypt, of our persecution, of our slavery, of our suffering, and then of the great events and the wonders and the signs that God took us out of Egypt and brought us to the land of Israel. It's time to tell a story. If I were writing the Haggadah, I guess what I'd want to do is to say at this point, let's open up the beginning of the book of Exodus that describes in 13 chapters exactly what happened, blow by blow, play by play, step by step. Beginning of Exodus is when the slavery begins. Then it tells all about Pharaoh's plan to depopulate the Jews, all his plan to enslave them to throw the firstborn into the Nile, etc., etc., etc. Then it goes through God choosing Moses at the burning bush, and Moses going to Egypt to take the Israelites out of slavery, and the 10 plagues in great, great detail, and then the last plague, and then the Seder, and then them leaving, and with the matzah. It's all there in 13 chapters. But the Haggadah never tells us to open those 13 chapters and to read and see actually what's going on. The Haggadah tells us actually something very, very different. And I want to go back now 2,000 years to the Mishnah, the code of Jewish law from 2,000 years ago, and show the way we're told to tell the story. And that is going to be found nowhere. It looks like I didn't photostat it. Let me try once again. Okay, I didn't photostat it. Too bad. I'll have to tell it to you orally. The Mishnah tells us that when you come to tell the story, open up to the book of Deuteronomy and expound upon one paragraph. And I want to read in the book of Deuteronomy now that one paragraph. Okay? So, look at Deuteronomy, where we were. It's page 314. Actually, let's go back to page 313. The bottom of page 313, it's chapter 26 of the book of Deuteronomy. Here we go. Page 313 at the bottom. When you enter the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a heritage, and you possess it and settle in it, you shall take some of every first fruit of the soil which you harvest from the land that the Lord your God is giving you, put it in a basket, and go to the place where the Lord your God will choose to establish his name. You shall go to the priest in charge at that time and say to him, I acknowledge this day before the Lord your God that I have entered the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to assign us. The priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down in front of the altar of the Lord your God, etc. We'll read on in a second. I'm just going to explain. This is the commandment. It's called the commandment of the first fruits, the Bikurim. You're a farmland of Israel, and you're very happy and satisfied with your crop. So the first grapes and the first figs, the first fruits, you take to the temple in Jerusalem, you say, thank God. Okay? That's what's going on. Nothing to do with the Passover Seder. We'll tie it in 1 minute. I want to point out something very interesting in what we just read. Look at verse 2. Verse 2 had said, you'll take some of the first fruit of the soil, which you harvest from the land that the Lord, your God, is giving you. Put in a basket and go to the place where the Lord your God will choose to establish his name. Will choose is future, of course. These verses are being spoken by Moses in the desert before they enter the land of Israel. And he's telling them, in the future, when you enter the land and you have crops and you're successful and you have first fruits, then you'll bring it to the place that God will choose to put his name there. That, of course, is going to be Jerusalem. But it's talking about the future. Okay? Verse 3, you shall go to the priest in charge at that time. Time. Again, emphasis, it's not about the present, it's about the future. In another 100 years, another 1,000 years, whatever priest is in that time, when you have your first fruits, go to the priest in that time, to the Kohen. Okay? Okay. And what do you say to the Kohen? You say, I'm reading from verse 3, I acknowledge this day before the Lord your God that I have entered the land that the Lord swore to our fathers to assign us. Do you see the chronological tension here? The person who's going to live at some time in the future land of Israel, another 20 years or 200 years or 2,000 years, he'll go to the priest in his time when he brings the first fruits, and he's going to say, thank you for these fruits. And how is he going to say thank you? By saying, I acknowledge that I have entered the land. But he didn't enter the land. His great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather entered the land. Right? It's in the time of Moses. Moses dies, and the Jews are entering their land. And it'll be far in the future that they'll have first fruits. In those days, whoever the priest will be in those days. But when you come to the priest and you say, thank you for the fruit, you say, I First person, I have entered the land. Even though it's really not I, it's really my father or my great-grandfather or great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather entered the land. How can I say I entered the land? Because of what I talked about an hour ago. Expanding your sense of personal identity. What my grandfather did is part of my life story. What my great-great-great-great-grandfather experienced is part of my life story. What Abraham experienced is part of my life story. That's the idea. In other words, again, nothing to say there yet, but you see it's getting connected. This commandment of the first fruits, you thank God for the fruit, but you also thank Him for the land that you entered, even though the you is the expanded you. Let's read on. Okay? Nechama, do you have the place? Just want to make sure.
Yes, yes.
Okay. The priest shall take the basket of the first fruits from your hand, I'm reading verse 4, and set it down in front of the altar of the Lord your God. You shall recite as follows before the Lord your God. My father was a fugitive Aramean. That's the verse in the Haggadah. Remember that verse from just 5 minutes ago? You tell the story, you tell this story as you bring your first fruits. My father was a fugitive Aramean. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there. So what does it mean? It means Jacob was a wandering Aramean. He was down in Mesopotamia, and then he went down to Egypt, right? With meager numbers. That was Jacob and his sons. He went down with 70 souls to Egypt and sojourned there. But there he became a great and a very populous nation. Right? That's the story of the Jewish people. We became numerous in Egypt. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. The Lord freed us from Egypt with a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm and awesome power, and by signs and portents. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Wherefore I now bring the first fruits of the soil which you, our Lord, have given me. Okay? That's the midst of the first fruits, the command of the first fruits. And what it's saying is, when you bring your first fruits, say thank you. But say thank you, not for the little picture, for the big picture. Say thank you that I had a forefather 1,000 years ago. And my forefather went down to Egypt. My forefather there was saved from slavery and God took him out of there and brought him into the land. And now I'm here in the land. In other words, you tell your story, but your story is a very, very long, big story of the collective, because the collective is me. Okay. Now we still don't understand what this has anything to do with the Passover Seder, because it's not about Passover. It's about the mitzvah of the first fruits. Okay? Everyone's with me? You're okay, Linda?
Yes.
Dan, you're okay? Good. So now, the strangest thing happens. In the Mishnah, that's the text, the Code of Jewish Law from 2,000 years ago, it says that when you get to the center of your Seder, you want to tell the story, it doesn't say that you open up the book of Exodus and tell and read the 13 chapter story of everything that happened. Rather, what we're told to do is open up the book of Deuteronomy and begin expounding from chapter 26, verse 5, which is what I just read. See verse 5, verse 6, verse 7, verse 8, etc. Tell the story to your children, not by reading from Exodus, but by taking these 4 or 5 or 6 verses in Deuteronomy and expounding upon them. Now, before I go deeper into what that means, I just want to show you that that's exactly what we do in our Haggadah. Okay? So we have opened the text of Deuteronomy, but at the same time we're going back to the Haggadah, and I want to show you where Deuteronomy is in the Haggadah. Okay? So look in the Haggadah on page 32 and 33 at the top. And this is a great Haggadah to learn this in, because what this Haggadah does is it puts the biblical text in bold. So, I'm reading in bold at the top. An Aramean attempted to destroy my father. Then he descended to Egypt and sojourned there. With few people in there, he became a nation great, mighty, and numerous. That's Deuteronomy 26:5. And you can look now in Deuteronomy 26:5 and see. It's a different translation, but it's the same words. Okay? Now, I want everyone to look at the bottom of the page, where my finger is. Right? It says, the Egyptians did evil to us and inflicted us and imposed hard labor upon us. Deuteronomy 26:6. That's the next verse.
Right.
Okay? Turn the page to the middle of page 35. Okay, middle of 35, where it says, we cried. We cried out to Hashem, the God of our fathers, and Hashem heard our cry, saw our affliction, our burden, our oppression. Deuteronomy 26:7. That's the next verse in Deuteronomy. Look at the bottom of the page. Hashem brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, with outstretched arm, with great awe, with signs and wonders. That's Deuteronomy 26:8, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's stop there for a second. What did the Haggadah do? It brought Deuteronomy chapter 26, verses 5, 6, 7, and 8. Which again has nothing to do with Passover, it's about the first fruits. Now, what about what we just skipped in the Haggadah? Let's go back to page 33 at the top. What happens in the Haggadah after the Haggadah quotes the verse 26:5 at the top? Then everyone notices that there are little snippets in bold. What are those little snippets?
Elaborating on each of the little phrases in the sentence above.
That's the answer to my next question. But what are just those snippets in bold? It's not elaborating.
They're bullet points.
That's
really
the quotes from...
Right, it's a quote. It's not yet the elaboration,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right?
It's re-quoting, right? We brought the whole verse, then we quote a snippet from the same verse.
Right.
Do you see that? Yeah. Do you see that, Karen?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So we quote snippets of the verse, and after we quote the snippet, then we do what Carolyn said. We elaborate on those snippets. That elaboration is called drasha, expounding. We finished expounding on the verse, we quote the next verse and expound upon it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we quote the next verse and expound upon it the next verse. Okay, so now we understand the structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to ask a question. Here we are sitting at the Seder, and we have a mitzvah to pass on to our children the story of what happened to us in Egypt. And we all know that that story is originally recounted at the beginning of the book of Exodus in 13 chapters. 13 chapters of exactly what happened from A to Z. And here we are at the Seder, and our tradition tells us not to read that story in Exodus. It's about 3,000 words. But rather to take these four or five verses from Deuteronomy and expound upon them. Why? Why do you think our tradition told us don't read from the 13 chapters in Exodus, but rather take four measly verses in Deuteronomy and expound upon them? It's the same story. What's the difference? Why not take the real thing from Exodus? Why take a little summarized version,
synopsis,
and...
Well, first of all, you couldn't do the 13 chapters in one night at the Seder.
It'd take a long time.
It'd take a long time.
Let's read fast. We'll read fast.
Not that fast.
If you read that fast, you're not going to get it.
If you read that fast, you're not going to get it. Good.
And you have hungry people.
And you have hungry people.
The hungrier they get.
Okay, that's part of the same point. The less they listen. So let's, more reasons. More reasons, yes.
We did this before with Rabbi Ibn Ezra recounting something that was important. This is a recounting of something important.
Right. Very good.
Yeah.
Now I want to go something deeper. Still the question of why do we use these verses in Deuteronomy and expound upon them instead of the verses in Exodus, the blow-by-blow, play-by-play account. I want to talk about what's it called in English? Person. First person, second person, third person, grammar.
Mm-hmm.
In Exodus it says, Moses did this, Paro did that, God did that, the elders did that, the advisor of Paro did that. What person is it in? First person, second person, or third person?
First person.
No, in Exodus. Paro did that. Moses did that.
It's
in third person.
Third.
It's all in the third person. Now, I'm going to go back and read the verses in Deuteronomy. Beginning in Deuteronomy 26, verse 6. Okay? the Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. The Lord freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm, and awesome power, and by signs and portents. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. I rest my case. In other words, there are a number of reasons why the tradition chose to use these verses in Deuteronomy for the centerpiece of the Seder, as opposed to the verses in Exodus. Reason number one, the verses in Exodus are too long, too much, too elaborate, and if you use those verses, you'd end up reading. We use the verses in Deuteronomy because they're short, and you have to expound upon them using your own words. You end up telling your own story. You engage in a process of free midrash. That's the first reason why the tradition chose the verse in Deuteronomy, because it forces you to explain from your own kishkes, your own experience, your own understanding. Reason number two that tradition chose the verses in Deuteronomy is because they're in the first person plural, the us, as opposed to the verses in Exodus, which are on the third person, they, him, Paro, the Israelites, Moses, the advisors. No. In Exodus, they were redeemed. In Deuteronomy, we were redeemed. And the two points I made now come together. We use the verse in Deuteronomy because they're short and they force us to add our own experiences, again, our own, and because they're in the first person, which again is the same point of our experience. It's about us. It's about that collective identity we've been talking about for the past 2.5 hours. Right? Mm-hmm. So this is really important. So what do we have here in the Haggadah? We have here a drasha. Can I use that word, drasha? And a sermon expounding upon the verses in Deuteronomy. Now listen to this. What would happen if I had a Seder at my house, and when we got to this point in the Haggadah, we read what it says? We read this page, page 35 and 36 and 37. We read this drasha. If I were to, at my Seder, read the Haggadah at this point, I'd be doing just the opposite of what the tradition wants. Because if I read the Haggadah, I might as well read the verses from Exodus. It's about reading. What we have in the Haggadah is not something you're supposed to read. What we have here is an example of a personal expounding. But what you're supposed to do is expound, not read. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. When you say expound,
Lidrosh, explain. No, expound means to explain. Here are the verses in Deuteronomy. There are only four verses. How many words? 110 words. If you just read the verse in Deuteronomy, you certainly haven't done the right thing. But if you read someone else's drasha, someone else's expounding, you've fallen back into the pit, into the fall of the cliff. You're just reading. The mitzvah is to expound. In my Seder, at my home, we've done one or two things. Some years, I have a big poster, like the one that just fell on the floor, in which the verses from Deuteronomy are written. And then we read those verses and we expound upon them word by word, thereby skipping four pages in the Haggadah. We're doing what the Haggadah is giving an example of. But if you read the Haggadah, you've not done what you're supposed to do. But then I discovered that if I just skip those four pages in the Haggadah and expound everyone around the table giving their input to the verses from Deuteronomy, people say, no, that's not traditional enough. We don't like this. They feel uncomfortable. So now what we do is we read the Haggadah, but we don't read it through. We read one word, and then we expound upon the expounding. Then we need another and expound upon the expounding. Let's do it now. So here we are. We're going back. Now we're having a Seder. Okay? So we're having our Seder with the top of page 33. And it says there, top of page 33 in the bold.
When are we eating?
You have the table is filled with karpas. You wouldn't even ask me that because you've been munching all the time.
Oh, thank you.
You've been eating carrots. You've been eating celery. You've been eating Paro's hard-boiled head. An Aramean attempted to destroy my father. Then he descended to Egypt and sojourned there with few people, and there he became a nation great, mighty, numerous. Okay. Then he descended to Egypt, compelled by divine decree. But then I'll ask everyone around the table, do you agree? Is it true that when our forefather Jacob descended to Egypt, was it really compelled by divine decree? Why does the Haggadah say that? Does anyone know why the Haggadah says? Again, this is a drasha. This is one particular rabbi's understanding of how to understand the verses. But it's not the only understanding. So he claims that he was compelled by the divine decree. What divine decree do you think he's talking about?
Is that when God spoke to Abraham?
Very good. Very good. Remember, we read that a few hours ago, that Abraham had a vision that said, yes, you're going to get the land, but first you're going down to slavery. So you could say that when Jacob left the land of Israel in the famine, it was really part of a divine plan. It really wasn't his choice. But then I'll say, Karen, do you agree with that? Just because of divine prophecy, does that obligate every... Is that like forcing every individual? No. I mean, there's divine prophecy that ultimately the Jewish people will come back to the land of Israel. Does that force you to make Aliyah? Just because it's divine prophecy? Not necessarily. Right? So is there another verse that in the Torah indicates that Jacob was forced by God to go from Canaan to Egypt?
It was a famine.
Was he forced by divine decree? Well, perhaps you'll say that the famine was divine decree. And it was forcing him to fulfill the vision. But on the other hand, he could have stayed another few years and tried to tough it out, right? Really, why did he go down at the time of the famine? Because he heard that, who was the viceroy of the country?
Yosef,
right? So here is the centerpiece of the Seder. And what's supposed to develop here is a discussion and expounding upon these verses. You're not supposed to read the verses in Exodus, certainly. And you're not really just supposed to read the expounding in the Haggadah. But the expounding should be a foundation for expounding. So you have on the table a Tanakh. Of course, assuming you have guests who know a little bit. If you don't, then you have to prepare them before the Seder. You have to say, you prepare this. You learn these three chapters in Genesis. You learn these four chapters in Exodus. I'm going to ask you questions, and there's going to be a discussion. It's about a discussion. Next, he sojourned there. Right? That's a quote from Deuteronomy. And the Haggadah gives an example of expounding. This teaches that our father Jacob did not descend to Egypt to settle, but only to sojourn. That's why it says sojourn. But is that true? If you say that Jacob went down to Egypt just to sojourn, then when the famine ended, why didn't
he come back?
Why didn't he come back to the land of Israel? Now, it's clearly that the Haggadah has an agenda. It's trying to tell us that a Jew shouldn't leave Israel for Los Angeles and just settle there. It's only be sojourning. Because he just planned to sojourn. But wait a second. If he planned to sojourn, why did he stay there so long? He died and the family stayed. His children grew up and the family stayed. There's a discussion, right?
Because now they they don't know any other place.
Yeah, right. And how many Israelis do I know that came to America for a few years?
And they stayed?
And they stayed, and the kids grew up in America, and their kids are Americans. So now the parents can't go back because their kids want to stay here. This is complicated stuff, right? This is relevant.
Also, when you do well, you stay in the place. Because
yeah.
It's serious.
It's comfortable. You're successful.
Was it 400 years we were in Egypt as a nation?
The computations are not clear. There are different computations. One place the Torah says 400 years, another says 430. Other computations, the rabbis come to 210 years.
Right, but we were slaves only for 110. Is that correct?
For 210.
210.
You know what? It's not clear. I'm not going to... I take back what I said.
Okay.
It might only be 110. Yeah.
So there were more years that there were not slaves in Egypt than they were slaves.
I'm not certain about that, but there could have been. Okay, so we read here the drasha, the expounding, and we can have a discussion on it. And then it says, with few people. That's a verse from the book of Deuteronomy. But of course the question is, how many is a few? So it quotes from another verse in Deuteronomy from a different place, Deuteronomy 10:20, to tell us how many people, with 70 people. Your forefathers descended to Egypt, now Hashem your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. But I can ask a question around the table. Where else does it say in the Torah that they descended with 70 people to the land of Egypt? It doesn't just say it in Deuteronomy. It says it someplace also in the book of Genesis. Find the place. And then I just remember my kids looking, where is it? Oh, I forgot to tell you something. And this is an overall piece of advice in the Seder. When I was much younger, I had the idea of counterfeiting money. But I didn't counterfeit American money and I didn't counterfeit Israeli money. I counterfeited Egyptian money. And the Egyptian money that I counterfeited were zuzim. Zuz is the Aramaic word for a penny. And I printed about 1,000 zuz. And I cut them out and I had them on the table in a pile. One zuz. And at the beginning of the Seder, I told the kids that whenever I ask a question, I ask lots of questions throughout the Seder. I have prepared lots of questions on a sheet, and others I think of as we're going on. I ask questions, and anyone who asks a question gets a zuz. And the kids are always trying to see who is more zuzim. Some questions give one zuz, some give two, some give three, some give five. And not only did we ask a lot of questions to the Seder, myself and my wife, to give out zuzim, but at this point in the Seder, when it becomes really a free drasha, of everyone participating, everyone who participates in the drasha and the expounding gets a zuz. Now, don't ask me the hard question, is how much are the zuzim worth at the end of the night? Depends how rich you are. My zuzim weren't worth almost anything.
Most, what do you get?
You redeem them for a prize or for real money.
Right.
Or something, yeah.
Right, you deem that for a prize or for real money. How much is the prize? That every family has their own standards.
It's a conversion run.
Yeah. And is there an app for that?
I hadn't thought of that. In my days, there were no apps and there were no cell phones.
But I have a 6-year-old grandson who will say that. Is there an app for that?
So next, we're continuing our drasha. There he became a nation. And the darshan, that's the rabbi who's writing this drasha, has the impression that when it says that we became a nation, well, that teaches you not only something quantitative, but also something qualitative. To say they became a nation doesn't just mean they became lots and lots of people in Egypt, but they became something that distinguishes them from other people. They became a nation.
From the Egyptians.
From the Egyptians. And therefore, the drasha says this teaches that the Israelites were distinctive there. But then I'll ask a question. I'm just giving you examples of how to conduct a flowing drasha. What do you mean the Egyptians were distinctive? Aren't there specific verses at the beginning of the book of Exodus that teach us actually that they weren't distinctive and they lived intermingled with the Egyptians? Anyone know how I can prove they lived intermingled with the Egyptians? Yeah. Bruce, for two zoos.
No, I'm just thinking that they intermarried with the Egyptians.
How do we know?
It just makes sense.
How to prove it?
Yeah.
I'll give you a hint. Blood on the doorpost.
Firstborn of...
But what does it prove about intermingling? Blood on the doorpost.
Purity.
You mean the mezuzah?
Yeah, what does it prove? It says that in Egypt, that during the Seder, they put blood on the doorpost from the Paschal Lamb, so that the destroying angel would know which houses...
To pass over.
How does it prove they were intermingled? If all the Jews lived in Borough Park, they wouldn't have to put blood on the doorpost. They're all Jewish together. Obviously, they lived intermingled with the Egyptians.
I see what you're saying.
So this, then you...
And only the people who put blood on the doorpost would be people who said, I'm a Jew.
Right.
Who said, I am part of...
That's also true. Right? That was an act of identification with the Jewish people. But it probably indicates that there were lots of Egyptians and Jews living intermingled. And the question is, to what degree the Jews were really distinctive in Egypt? It's an open question. There's a verse at the beginning of chapter 1 of Exodus, verse 6, that says, the land was filled with them. There became so many Israelites, the land was filled with them. Doesn't that sound like it?
Sure.
It wasn't just Borough Park, right? And it wasn't just the southern Arugula of Dallas, they lived all over. Right?
I thought they did live in one certain section of Egypt.
They lived in Goshen at the beginning. That's in the time of Joseph. But it looks like they expanded. There's actually a midrash that says that the verse that says the land was full of them means they were in the circuses and the amphitheaters. They were in the places of culture. They were in the discotheques. Right?
Was Goshen a city or was it an area?
A region. Was it
a region?
Area. Yeah.
Yes, but
yeah.
When they came to Goshen, they were only 70.
Yeah, and then they expanded.
They were Orthodox, weren't they?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I wasn't there.
Yeah, well, but in those days, you expanded however you expanded. That's, you didn't have any choice, yes or no.
So now, let's go on a little bit more. It says, great and mighty, right? That's the verse from Deuteronomy. We read the verses from Deuteronomy, and then the drasha says, as it says in Exodus 1:7, and the children of Israel were fruitful, increased greatly, multiplied, and became very, very mighty, and the land was filled with them. If you have any kids that are good at math, we might ask them, so do the math. How did 70 become 600,000? How many years does that take? Numerous. The verse in Deuteronomy says they became numerous. And the drasha says, as it says in the book of Ezekiel. This is getting interesting now. I made you as numerous as the plants of the field. You grew and developed and became charming, beautiful of figure, your hair grown long, but you were naked and bare. And I passed over you and saw you downtrodden in your blood, and I said to you, through your blood shall you live, and I said to you, through your blood shall you live. So, on the one hand, something on the basic level, it's clear. The verse in Deuteronomy says the Israelites became numerous. In order to expound upon that, we bring the verse from Ezekiel that says they became numerous as the plants of the field. Okay, that's how numerous they were as the plants of the field. But we say this ourselves, wait a second. There's lots of verses in the Torah and in the Bible that say that the Israelites in Egypt became numerous. Why did our darshan, our rabbi, choose this verse from Ezekiel? Let's look at the verse again. I made you as numerous as the plants of the field. You grew and developed and became charming, beautiful of figure. So first of all, I'll just tell you, and it's on the sheet that I brought, you could look at it at home, the darshan, the expounding rabbi, is hinting to a midrash that talks about the fact that the Israelites were literally like plants of the field in Egypt. Because, oh, it's a long story, I shall tell a little of it. It says that, well, I can't tell the whole story, but basically the Egyptians plowed under the Jews, literally made of them little pieces, and killed them all with plows. But then the Israelites sprouted like potatoes in the field. And there were more of them. And that midrash is based on this idea of numerous as the plants of the field. We literally sprouted from the fields when the Egyptians tried to plow us under. But that's a whole different story. You can see the midrash here. But there's more to it. You grew and developed, became charming, beautiful of figure, your hair grown long, you were naked and bare, and I passed over and saw you downtrodden in your blood. The darshan is bringing this verse from Ezekiel, not just because of the numerous, but because it's an image that God saw us in our blood. And there's a midrash that says, what blood did he see? The blood of the sacrificial lamb. The Passover lamb. And seeing that blood is what allowed us to be redeemed, of course. But now let me ask you something. Don't you notice that the verse in Ezekiel says twice, through your blood shall you live, and I said to you, through your blood shall you live. Two bloods there were in Egypt, not just the blood of the Paschal lamb, but another blood.
Bloodline. Bloodline?
No. The blood of circumcision. Jewish tradition teaches us that they had to circumcise themselves, the males, before the redemption. And it's because of the blood of circumcision and the blood of the Paschal lamb that they were redeemed. All that is hidden here, all that's hidden in the use of this verse from Ezekiel in this drasha, and my suggestion would be that at your seder, you build drasha upon drasha upon drasha, you weave ideas. Of course, you have to do a lot of work beforehand and look all these things up. and you could have assigned different articles and different verses to people to read so they can lead the discussion. There's a lot of preparation to be done.
I understood this year that, well, I've known that 3 million, there were approximately 3 million that were in the exodus, right?
We say there were 600,000 men, and then women and children, so it could come to 2 million. Two million.
But they were only one quarter, 25% of those people who left.
Actually, 20%.
20%.
Yeah.
So there were really 10 million or 12 million, 10 to 12 million who Jews from 70 people.
So I'll tell you something.
Goes to show what their hobby was.
So all the Jews didn't leave Egypt.
The Midrash says, and it's based on verses in the Torah that aren't explicit but are almost explicit, that only a small number left, only those who made the effort to identify themselves as Jews by putting the blood on the doorpost.
And the others stayed
and either were killed in the plague of the firstborn because they didn't put the blood, the firstborn killed, and others might have just assimilated and stayed. So now, we have another 20 minutes. I gave you an example of at the centerpiece of the Seder what you should really do with the plaque on the wall of the verses from Deuteronomy, looking at those verses, looking at the drasha here, and building your own drasha with all the people in the room based on the verses and based on the drasha here, and it goes on through the next verses as well. Let me just point out in this drasha, I won't go through the rest of it, but you understand the way it works. The last verse that's brought in the drasha is the bottom of page 35. Look at the bottom of 35. Hashem brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, with great awe, with signs and with wonders. Deuteronomy 26:8. And it goes on with a drasha of that verse. However, look now back in the verses in the Bible, in the Torah. It was chapter 26, right? Everyone still has it open. And you see verse 8, which we said is the last verse that's brought in the Haggadah. And we'll read verse 8 back in the Torah. Okay, I'm going to read verse 8. The Lord freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm and awesome power, and by signs and portents. But that's not the end of the story. There's a verse 9. Verse 9 does not appear in the Haggadah. Let's read verse 9. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That's the end of the historical story. But verse 9 is missing from the Haggadah. So I'll just tell you briefly that there are a lot of different scholarly articles written. Why is verse 9 missing from the Haggadah? And the answer could be very obvious. Because it could be that what we have in our hands is a Haggadah that's reflective of Jewish experience in the diaspora. When there is no verse 9, he brought us to this place, so gave us this land flowing with milk and honey. That is the end of the story, but our forefathers telling this story when they were in Eastern Europe or in Spain, they couldn't say that last verse because to them it wasn't true. And that brings us to the question, should we reinsert that verse back into the Haggadah? So I'll just tell you that many of my colleagues in Israel, a number of them have developed Haggadot, in which they are putting this verse back in the Haggadah with appropriate drashot. So I can certainly recommend, or at least bring up the possibility to you, that at this point in the Haggadah, you don't end with the drashot on verse 8, but you add verse 9. Because it's not merely a matter of your personal experience, we're all in America, but our collective experience of the Jewish people is that we have been brought into the land of milk and honey in our generation. And it would be, in my opinion, grossly inappropriate, to tell the story of the Jewish people this night and leave out what it was really about. It was about slavery to freedom, but it was also about a larger story of exile to the land, and we have consummated that journey in our generation. It belongs in the Haggadah. So bring verse 9 back into the Haggadah. At least that's what many do today. Okay. So in the Haggadah, all through page 37 is still a drasha on Deuteronomy 8. If you look at the whole page of 37, with a mighty hand and bold face and with outstretched arm, with great awe, with signs and wonders, that's all. That's all still the drasha of 38. And then it says, what were some of the wonders? Blood, fire, and columns of smoke. That's still part of the drasha of that verse 8. You go to the next page, page 39, it's still a drasha. It's still a drasha of that last verse in chapter 26, verse 8 of Deuteronomy, that says God brought us out with signs and wonders, and it's talking all about the many, 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 many signs and wonders. It's all still in the framework of drasha on chapter 26, verse 8 of the book of Deuteronomy. Where does the drasha end? The drasha ends the top of page 41. Rabbi Akiva said, how does one derive that each plague in that the Holy Blessed be inflicted on Egypt was equal to five plagues? It's still part of a drasha. What does it mean that God brought us with signs and wonders? Rabbi Akiva says that each plague was actually five plagues. And when Rabbi Akiva finishes his drasha, that's the end of the drashot on the verses in Deuteronomy. And then we sing a song, right? Dayenu, everyone knows the song? And Dayenu, of course, is a summary of the whole story in song form. Right? God did this and God did that. He split the sea for us. He drowned the oppressors, parted for our needs in the desert. And isn't it interesting that the song Dayenu really does put the whole story in its larger perspective? It doesn't just end with the slavery to freedom, but it goes to the desert and Mount Sinai, and the end of the song is that he brought us to the land of Israel. So although the drasha doesn't include the verse from Deuteronomy that says he brought us to this good land, that's been lost from the Haggadah, I assume it was once there, but the song does include that larger tapestry, that the ultimate goal of the whole thing was to bring us into the land of Israel. The middle of verse of chapter, I'm sorry, the middle of page 43 is thanks. We end the song by thanking for all those things, right? Mm-hmm. And then we get to Rabban Gamliel. You see where Rabban Gamliel is?
Yes.
Rabban Gamliel is a retelling of the story in a different fashion. Until now, we told the story as a drasha on the verse in Deuteronomy, a drasha that was basically chronological. This happened, then that happened, then that happened. We went from A to B to C to D. Rabban Gamliel tells the story not chronologically, but through reference to the three major symbols on the table. So it's another way to fulfill the mitzvah, not by a chronological story, but by saying, here's the Passover lamb, why do we eat it? Here's the matzah, here's the maror, why do we eat it? So let's just read. Rabban Gamliel used to say, whoever has not explained the following three things on Passover has not fulfilled his duty, namely Passover offering, the unleavened bread, and the bitter herbs. And it goes through each of the three and explains them. Passover, why did our fathers eat a Passover offering? And it gives the answer.
What page are you on?
43 at the very bottom.
43.
43 at the very bottom.
Okay.
And then after the Passover offering, we turn to the next page, the matzah. And if you remember, we talked about this matzah 2 hours ago. Mm-hmm. The matzah, and it says, because we went from slavery to freedom quickly, it didn't have time to rise, and then the maror. I'm going to take now 3 minutes to say something about the Passover offering, since it's right here in the Haggadah. And it's something I hinted to earlier. And I'm saying this in the name of my neighbor, my friend, my colleague, a very famous Bible teacher. His name is Rabbi Menachem Liebtag. And Caroline has heard this from me 10 times, I think. It's clear from the Torah that the Egyptians worshipped the sheep. Worshipped them. They did not slaughter them, and they did not eat them. Perhaps they used them for their wool and their milk, but they did not eat them. Why does the Torah command us in the final meal we're eating as Egyptian slaves before we go to freedom, why does the Torah command that the centerpiece of the meal is to be a sheep or a goat that's to be slaughtered? You're supposed to roast it whole after keeping it and waiting for 4 days, and then eat it and smear the blood on the doorpost. The reason that this is commanded, according to Rabbi Menachem Liptag, is as an act of civil disobedience. To say it differently, an act of repudiation of the idolatrous culture of Egypt. The Israelites have been assimilated in this country. They've been slaves, but they've also been assimilated to the country. We know that from many verses. And God says, I'm going to redeem you if you're willing to repudiate Egypt, their culture, their religion, everything about them. Take a lamb and hold it on your front lawn for 4 days. That's what the Torah says, 4 days. Why? So that everyone will see what you're about to do.
A live lamb.
A live lamb. And then slaughter it before the sun goes down on the 14th of the month of Nisan. And roast it whole. Why roast it whole? So that it makes a lot of smoke and you can't do it inside. The whole thing, you're not allowed to roast it in pieces. So that you make a big public display of the fact that you're killing the god of the Egyptians. And then smear the blood on the doorpost so everyone will see what you've just done. The equivalency in our day, says Rabbi Liptag, is a commandment to burn the American flag on your front lawn and smear the ashes on the front door. That's a hard thing to do. It means completely repudiating the culture you've been part of. It means risking your life. It means showing yourself and the world you're going to something new. You're turning over a new leaf. You're following Moses and God into the desert. That's not an easy thing to do. And that brings us back to the 1 in 5. Most were unable to do that. Because I don't like slavery, but Egypt is a good place and perhaps the slavery would end sometime. It's just a passing phenomena. And there's the Nile River here. There's good food. There's a living. Could make a living. Am I going to follow Moses and God into the desert? I might starve there. Might have nothing to eat. Who knows if we can believe those promises of this God and this Moses? So the Jews had to make a decision. So here they are in this final meal. The final lamb meal. They're eating the matzah that symbolizes, as we've talked about, slavery. The bitterness of slavery. They also have the bitter herbs at that meal. And the centerpiece of the meal is the Korban Pesach, the sacrificial lamb. And only those who had it within them had the courage and the guts to slaughter this lamb and put the blood on the doorpost, only they were redeemed. Because only they have done what the wicked son couldn't do. Remember? Include himself in the community, in the we. This night is all about including yourself in the we. That is what it all boils down to.
So this was all done before the 10th plague.
This is all done a few hours before the 10th plague. Literally a few hours. Right? Beginning 4 days before, and then the meal is just a few hours before.
Right.
Right, that's what's happening. Okay. So at this point in the Seder, we finished the mitzvah of the night. The command of the night is telling the story. We just finished it when we just said Rabban Gamliel's Pesach Matzah Maror, Paschal Lamb, unleavened bread, bitter herbs. We've explained the story not only chronologically but also with these three Seder symbols. We're finished. The rest is icing on the cake. I'm reading now at the bottom of page 45 as we're about to end here. Bottom of 45, in each generation, it is one's duty to regard himself as though he personally had gone out of Egypt as it is written, etc. That sums it all up. You were there. It's your story. It's your life.
So it's the individual,
I think. Right.
Only himself.
No. To see yourself that you're not just living the 21st century. That you are part of what went on 3,000 years ago. It was me. It was you. This, by the way, is an opportunity for me to tell you another one of the props that I use at the Seder. We talked about the arrow. We also have a chain, and little kids like to make chains, right, from cardboard. And what we did, we hung this chain right across the whole living room, and then I had the kids, they drew the pictures, or we had them fill in color from things we got off the internet, pictures of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Aaron, Joshua, going through the generations of Jewish history up until me and them, seeing themselves on the chain. And of course the idea is that it's all part of one chain, and you should see yourself as part of that chain. And when the kids are the ones that prepared the chain and drew all the pictures and put it up, then I think it has meaning. There was one year that I even hung up as part of the chain pictures of my great-grandfather and my grandfather. And then, of course, pictures of me and pictures of the kids, to make the point that we're all part of one family and one collective, and the stories we're telling about the past are really our stories. And that brings us to page 47. So again, I'll tell you that even though there are more Passover foods to be eaten, there's wine to be drunk, and there's matzah to be eaten, and the Seder, but as far as the mitzvah of telling the story, we're finished. So the top of page 47 is thanking God. We say a few psalms from Hallel, and at the end of page 47, we have the blessing that ends the mitzvah of telling the story. And it looks like we're going to end with that in our session. So let's read that blessing and talk about it a little bit. I'm at the bottom of page 47, five lines from the bottom of the page. Blessed art you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who redeemed us and redeemed our ancestors. Isn't that interesting? Redeemed us and redeemed our ancestors. Wouldn't it be enough to say redeemed our ancestors?
No, it's the purpose of the whole Haggadah, and I just realized it as you were talking, is to say that God will always be with us in the good times and the bad times. And this is the experience that he wants us to remember.
That it's one process, it's one story. Yeah. And he redeemed our ancestors, but he also redeemed us. And here, Bruce, it's in the past. It'll get to the present, but now it's in the past. In other words, the us and our ancestors, one is the same. Right? We are our ancestors, and our ancestors are us.
This is part of the promise, though.
Yes, yes. And it goes on. So, blessed art you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, who redeemed us, who redeemed our ancestors from Egypt, enabled us to reach this night, that we may eat matzah and maror. Again, process, chain, it's all one story. So, Hashem, our God, and God of our forefathers, bring us also to future festivals and holidays in peace. Gladdened in the rebuilding of your city, that's Jerusalem, and joyful in your service. There we shall eat of the offerings and Passover sacrifices whose blood will gain, that means blood will be splashed on the sides of your altar for gracious acceptance. In other words, as we tell the story of the past, and we say that sort of the past is our story, we also look at it as a continuing process, and we pray for future redemption that will be part of this same process. Now, okay, doesn't matter. And then it goes on, blessed are you, Hashem, who redeemed Israel. At that point, we've, again, finished the story, and then we eat the symbols of the night. We eat the matzah, and we eat the haroset. We don't have time for all of that stuff, unfortunately. So at this point, with just a few minutes left, I'll ask, does anyone want to ask a specific question or elaborate on something?
What Haggadah would you recommend?
What Haggadah would I recommend? I recommend that everyone have the same Haggadah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that it have as few commentaries as possible. Because I think that you want people to look at the commentaries before the Seder night. Whereas during the Seder, you want them to be together. You want them to be in a discussion. You don't want everyone reading the little notes. So I recommend a tiny booklet like this one.
So, but you said you had issues with the Masorah.
Right. I usually have issues with Art Scroll, but given everything that's available, I think this is really great.
Okay.
The translation, 9 places out of 10, is fine. The Maxwell's Haggadah, the translation is not good, and the printing is not good. Notice how here they didn't bold the verses, whereas the explanations were in unbold.
Well, you get,
this is good.
What you paid for with the Maxwell House one.
Yeah, which is free.
What about is there one with transliteration?
One with trans... I don't really know.
Okay.
As I know of Haggadot with commentaries, and there are lots of commentaries available.
We have that. The problem with that is to have 30 of them.
Yeah. So this is really good to have 30 of. It's relatively cheap, and it's not distracting. Again, you should have other Haggadot in the house for people to prepare with and from before the event. There are at least 1,000 Haggadot that are available in English. I brought here... This is a Haggadah that... ever seen this before? I once bought 8 of these because I wanted everyone to have the same Haggadah. In the end, I didn't really use them. If anyone, by the way, would want one, I'll sell it to you for 30% of the price. I just bought them here because I don't need them anymore. This has interesting commentaries, and it's designed to make it relevant to a typical American middle-class family.
Is that Zion?
Oh, right. I was going to mention that also. If you want a good Haggadah to prepare from, it's really made for American families in our generation. What Carolyn said, Noam Zion. It's called A Different Night. Let me put this name in. That doesn't rhyme. He writes it with Zion. Z. Noam Zion, A Different Night. And it is published by the Shalom Hartman Institute, which I know the Sherith Israel here has connections to. A Different Night, the Shalom Hartman Institute. That has a leader's guide and then has background material. And it brings in poetry and literature and history. It brings in Holocaust things. That's also part of our story. It's quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. Some of you know that the Chief Rabbi of England was here in Dallas a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He has a beautiful Haggadah with essays at the back that are just so enlightening. Yeah. And literally, there are literally thousands of Haggadot available.
He just resigned, is that correct?
Yes.
He's going to resign.
Yeah, I don't know if he resigned or didn't.
September is his last.
Oh, he has a few months? I wasn't aware.
I have a question about when it's the 10 plagues, we say them, and we dip our hand to... It symbolizes that we are not rejoicing at the destruction of our enemies?
Yes, yes.
So how does this correlate with the Paschal lamb that they are? It's like, it's not contradictory.
It doesn't contradict. The Paschal Lamb was about repudiating that culture, that we don't want to be part of that culture. That doesn't mean we want all the Egyptians dead.
When the women were dancing on the other side of the Sea of Reeds, I think Moshe cautioned them not to dance when people would die.
There's a Midrash absolutely that that talks about that.
That the Egyptians were dying.
That you shouldn't sing and rejoice.
Not to rejoice.
You can repudiate somebody's beliefs, but not wish evil upon them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I've learned that if I do this class next year, it should be 6 hours and not 3 hours.
Yeah. But you should serve celery and hard-boiled eggs.
Yes.
That's right.
Because we're nauseous. Yes.
I want to ask you a question at Mount Sinai now.
So it's not on the subject?
Not on this
subject. Then let me ask, does anyone else first have a question? No. And you know what? Let me end and then we'll talk about it.
Okay.
So I just wanted to say 1 minute about myself. I was introduced at the beginning, but I'll just read it a little bit more. My job here in Dallas is to teach adult education classes from a pluralistic, traditional perspective as part of the Jewish Studies Initiative of North Texas. And I just welcome everyone to participate in my classes. I have brochures that list some of the classes, and I'll give them out to those who want. And I also have a postcard about a interfaith series that I'm involved in. I do a lot of interfaith work here in Dallas with Muslims and Christians. And if you'd like to give me your name, we have a weekly e-blast, which I send out an essay and a weekly parsha and all the activities that are happening. I have the names of Karen and Bruce, but they're already on our list.
Yes.
So
yes.
If anyone else would like to, truth is,
do you have a list of the courses that you teach?
Yeah. I'd like to have a list of the courses.
Also, if we can let you know.